It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Today is 7-11, and this is episode 712 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, July 11th, 2021. I'm not sure what the bigger break was this week, Conor McGregor and his leg, or Jimmy Uso and the law? Or maybe it's WWE Network, breaking my heart with all of the original content they've been pulling as of late. Last month, they promoted a new WWE Untold special on the Nexus, only to pull it from the schedule with no explanation. Nothing has been said about it since. Then they were promoting the latest WWE Icon special on Lex Luger. They were timing it for July 4th when he slammed Yokozuna on the Intrepid. And then they pulled it at the last minute, again, with no explanation. Now they've been promoting Kevin Nash appearing on the Broken Skull Sessions today to coincide with the 25th anniversary of the NWO. And I do love me a good Kevin Nash shoot, but now I see they have pulled it from the schedule, and it looks like it is not dropping today after all. Even the Vladimir Superfan documentary, they put a trailer out for that a few months ago. It looked great. That was supposed to be released at some point this summer. It might still be. But there has been no update since then, and the person who directed it was one of the office members that WWE let go of in May. Now, I still expect all of these are going to air at some point, but what the hell is going on over there? You know, I had read that they pulled the Luger doc to give it a better lead-in. Maybe they'll tie it in with a pay-per-view or something. But now I'm not so sure, because it's not just the Luger doc. But you'll do pretty well for yourself if you use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. I promise you I will not pull that. That is there for those of you who want to sample the service and get yourself one free audiobook of your choosing. Get a free book courtesy of The Sound Off. Just use audibletrial.com/solomonster to sign up. You got a ton of wrestling books on there. I've been through them before. I've recommended a whole bunch of them, from Bob Holly to Justin Roberts. You know, you got Stone Cold books on there, and Daniel Bryan and Chris Jericho, and just a whole bunch of different people. So go ahead and take advantage of that. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. You'll see the button waving hi right there on the side of the... Well, it's not actually waving, but you'll see the button on the right-hand side of the page. And I want to give a shout-out this week to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, I hope you're having a great summer so far, my friend. Paul has been a tremendous friend to the show, as has the Loose Cannon himself, John Loose Cannon Lopez, one of our longtime diehards, Night Stalker Nayef Alsafar, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Fast Blast Tim Banks, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Ostentatious Alan Carter, John Raging Mad Riffle, Dark Soul Jeff Cole, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Michael Maximum Payne Palkowski, and Belt Fan Brent Banner. This week on the How Did We Even Get Here podcast, Brent and Trey talk about the Batman controversy, the T-Pain versus Usher feud, and the most embarrassing times they got in trouble with their parents. All that plus the FU of the week and good vibes only. You can find them on 13 different audio platforms. It's a very unlucky number. But lucky for you, they are on 13 different audio platforms. Just visit your favorite one and search How Did We Even Get Here? Or you can check out the video podcast on YouTube at tinyurl.com/getheretube. We are only 1 week away. This is your 1 week warning from the custom Solo Monster Championship Bell giveaway on WrestleRumble.com. You still have 7 days left to enter as of today. You can enter as many times as you like. It is $1 to enter the contest live after Money in the Bank next Sunday. I will be on YouTube for my recap, and during my Money in the Bank stream, I will be drawing a name at random, and it could be yours. And the winner is going to win a one-of-a-kind Solomonster Championship belt replica. There's only been two of these made. I own one. You could own the other. We could be a tag team. But the only way you can do that is by entering. So go to WrestleRumble.com. You've got 1 week left to go. Cast your, your voting here, but submit your entry before it is too late. This thing is very cool, and it's going to make a hell of a prize for whoever wins that contest. So get in on that. Thank you, by the way, to all of our new channel members on YouTube. I do appreciate your patronage, and you will have more retro audio going up for those of you on the Legends tier. We've got more video Q&As coming and some other fun stuff. So again, I thank you for your support. I dropped a Sound Off Extra on YouTube on Wednesday about Jimmy Uso's latest arrest, this whole mess of a situation. I didn't want to wait until Sunday. I'm going to play it again for you here, for those who did not hear it, because we do have, in some cases, two very distinct audiences here, one for the YouTube channel and one here for the main show. So if you didn't hear it, or if you did, it was so nice, I want you to hear it twice. And then I've got more thoughts on how they handled things Friday night on SmackDown, but it runs about 14 minutes. I think it's very important. And these are my thoughts on the Jimmy Uso situation. TMZ broke the news that Jimmy Uso was busted in Florida and charged with DUI after cops observed him, quote, driving erratically and swerving all over the road. They said he reeked of alcohol and refused a breathalyzer on the scene. He was released from jail after posting a $1,000 bond and has a court date set for August 15th. That was not from this week, by the way. What I just read to you was from Sound Off 610, back on July 28th, 2019. That arrest was days after John Cena cracked a joke on Raw in a segment with both Usos about how they look like their mugshots, because both of them had spent time behind bars multiple times. Jey Uso even gave a shout-out to the Hillsborough County Police Department. What a knee-slapper. A couple of comedians. How about we take it back to Sound Off 586? From February 17th of that same year. Per TMZ, Jimmy Uso was arrested this week after a drunken confrontation with cops in Detroit. Uso and his wife Naomi were pulled over near downtown Detroit after the cops allege Naomi was driving the wrong way down a one-way street. Cops say their SUV reeked of booze, so they ordered Naomi to get out of the car. While she was talking to the cops, Jimmy decided to get out of the car, took his shirt off, and squared up like he wanted to fight. And one of the cops then took out a taser, because I guess they feared for their life. And then Jimmy settled down, and he was arrested for disorderly conduct and obstruction and taken to jail, where he posted bond and was released. Let's go back even further to Sound Off 265 on March 17th, 2013, where I had this news to report. SmackDown wrestler Jimmy Uso was arrested Wednesday at 12:47 p.m. in Hillsborough County, Florida, and charged with driving under the influence. He did not stay in jail for long, as he was released on $500 cash bond later that day. There's still some fuel left in the DeLorean. One more time, let's go back to Sound Off 181. Boy, we're really going old school now. From October 1st, 2011, WWE wrestler Jimmy Uso was arrested for driving under the influence early Thursday, according to Tampa police. Uso was pulled over at 3:14 a.m. on the corner of Howard Avenue and Platt Street. Police say an officer observed the defendant traveling the wrong way on Howard Avenue in a silver Mustang. And according to the arrest report, his blood alcohol level was 0.180, more than double the legal limit. Fast forward to the present day. TMZ again reports that on Monday night, Jimmy Uso was pulled over at around 10:35 p.m. in Pensacola after cops say he ran a red light after being clocked going 50 in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. Officers say during subsequent questioning they smelled booze on the 35-year-old, so they asked him to exit his Dodge Charger. Cops say when he got out of his vehicle, he was noticeably swaying and claimed that Uso told them he had consumed multiple beers before getting behind the wheel. Officers say Uso went on to bomb field sobriety tests, so they arrested him. And in the police documents, cops claim that Uso's blood alcohol level came back at 0.202 and 0.205. Well above Florida's legal limit of 0.08. And according to jail records, Uso was booked on a misdemeanor DUI charge, and he was also hit with citations for speeding and running a red light. Hurricanes aren't the only danger that Florida residents should be worried about, based on all of these stories. You know what the scary part is? The scary part is these are the times that we know about. What about the ones that we don't? Where he was lucky enough not to get pulled over. The message here with all of these arrests, and the one Naomi was present for, just in the interest of clarity, that was not a DUI, nor was Naomi accused of anything. She was just driving. I think she legitimately got lost and was going the wrong way. But taken together, they all tell the same story, which is that Jimmy Uso has a problem with alcohol. This makes twice in the last 2 years that he's been hit with a DUI charge. The last one was dropped when a jury found him not guilty, despite there being video evidence of him swerving and stumbling around. Now, juries don't have to explain their verdict, but out of morbid curiosity, I would have loved to know how they reached that decision. There may have been a perfectly good explanation for it. Or maybe he got off on a technicality. We'll never know. But that's not even the point. There is a pattern here. A very disturbing pattern that reminds me a lot of the Matt Hardy stuff from about a decade back. And I know many people who listen to, you know, the Sound Off and have listened to the podcast going all the way back to then, you know exactly what I'm talking about, because it was almost like a weekly occurrence where I was talking, unfortunately, talking about Matt Hardy. It felt like every other week there was a new Matt Hardy story. DUI, DWI. His brother has had even more issues over the years, you know, with alcohol. Matt was in a bad place in his life back then, but he was also putting other people at risk by his stupid actions. And thankfully, he got himself clean. You know, to the extent that when you are addicted to something, you're never really, you know, not addicted. But what he's been able to do, by all accounts, since then, is put those problems behind him. And I'm hoping that Jimmy Uso can do the same. It's not that I don't have empathy, or that I don't understand what addiction is. I do have empathy. I do understand that alcoholism is a disease that can ruin people's lives and can lead them to make, you know, irresponsible, dangerous, dumb decisions. There are people listening to this right now who either are going through it themselves or know somebody who has. Unfortunately, that applies to a lot of people. But we're talking about a pattern of behavior that dates back at least 10 years. Again, that we know of. It could be longer. But 2011 was his first arrest. It's now 2021. And at what point do you say enough is enough? At what point do you take the keys away from the man and say you're no longer allowed to get behind the wheel and operate this 2-ton vehicle until you admit that you have a problem? And you make a real attempt to address that problem. Because Jimmy Uso isn't just putting himself at risk, he's putting other people at risk who share the road with him. Or who cross the street at the wrong moment. And my God, you know, when I tweeted about this yesterday, there were so many people tweeting at me, making all kinds of excuses for this guy. I hope I never share the road with any of these people. Holy shit. It would be like playing Grand Theft Auto.
And it comes at a time, and this is hardly the most important thing, but it comes at a time when this man is getting the biggest push of his life on television. He is a featured performer in main events. He's on television every week with Roman Reigns, the biggest star in the business right now. He's coming off a devastating knee injury that kept him on the sidelines for over a year, just itching to get back. And he does, and now he's in jeopardy of pissing it all away. Now, as of Wednesday afternoon, WWE has been silent on this. We haven't even gotten the obligatory Jonathan Fatu is responsible for his own action statement that we get for everybody else, and we've gotten for him in the past, going back to the first arrest. They could probably just do cut and paste. But they can't stay silent for much longer. They need to step in and they need to do something. And no, I don't think they're going to fire him. But I don't think they can just ignore it and pretend that it didn't happen either. Taking him off television for a while, that's very possible, even though it screws up the best story they have going right now on TV. He does a disservice not just to the company, but to his own brother because of this, which is the risk that you run when you're in a tag team. One member of the team gets hurt, or one member of the team gets in trouble. That affects both members. This case is unique because they're actually brothers. I mean, look, we all make mistakes. Nobody is perfect. One time is a mistake. By the time you get to the second, third, fourth arrest, you know, I hope Jimmy can admit that he has a problem and that he takes the steps necessary to address it. I have empathy. I do. I've got loads of empathy. But with all that empathy out of the way, revoke the man's fucking license and get him off the road before he kills someone. This man was nearly three times over the legal limit. Three times! When is enough enough? Do we wait until he kills a pedestrian who's crossing at the crosswalk? In the past, he was swerving and swaying. I mean, do we wait until he mows down a pedestrian? Do we wait until he kills another driver? Or seriously injures another driver? I mean, if he ends up convicted, and he hasn't been yet, not on this charge. I think on the first charge he was 10 years ago. The last one he got off. He'll have to return to court for this at a later date. In the meantime, what's to say he doesn't do this again? You know, at the very least, they have these ignition interlock devices which attach to the car and they require the driver to breathe into the device to check their blood alcohol level, you know, before they can start the engine. That may be an option for him if he's convicted, but I don't think he should be allowed to drive until he goes to rehab. And nobody can force him into rehab. He has to want to go. You know, WWE might be able to mandate it under the threat of termination if he refuses. They did something similar with Umaga. Umaga had a drug problem. He refused to go to rehab. They wanted him to go to rehab. He said no. And they fired him. And his story did not end well. I don't want to see the same thing happen here. Nor do I want to see anybody lose their job. The Usos are a great team. But if WWE goes to him and says, look, you need to do this or else, and he doesn't think he has a problem or he just refuses and doesn't want to do it, then you know what? As a company, they have to do what they have to do. It is embarrassing to them every bit as much as it is to him. It's not, you know, Jonathan Fatu was arrested. Every time this happens, it's WWE superstar Jimmy Uso was arrested again. And that can only go on for so long before WWE just washes its hands of him and says, you know what? We got to cut ties. Enough's enough. To blow more than twice the legal limit, that's not one or two beers. That is just beyond absurd. In an age where everyone has a smartphone with multiple apps you can use to call a car to pick you up, and yes, once you start drinking, I understand your judgment is impaired. It's going to not be what it is when you're sober. I get that. Or you may think, I'm fine. I'm fine to drive. But if you're going to be drinking that much, like I said, we're not talking one or two beers here. If you're going to be drinking that much, then decide before you get sloshed. You know what? I'm going to take a car home. There's no excuse. There is no excuse to put other people's lives at risk. There should be zero tolerance for this. And I see so many people making excuses. Stop with the excuses. Revoking his license would send a message. And again, what the specific guidelines are on that in Florida, I don't know, but revoking his license sure would send a message, especially when you're somebody who travels for a living. But I think we are past the point of simply hoping that he gets help. You can hope he gets help. I hope he gets help. But you can also take action. You don't just have to do one or the other. But for fuck's sake, get help. Because the sixth time I come on here to talk about another Jimmy Uso story on TMZ, it may not have a happy ending. So I recorded that on Wednesday, and since then, much like the cops, I'm sure, told Jimmy, WWE has remained silent. And it is a terrible look to not say anything. Not that they're responsible for his actions. One time is one thing. The second, third, and fourth time is a totally different situation. He is a featured performer on their shows. It is a terrible look to ignore this and look as if you are sweeping it under the rug, if that's what they're doing here. And Jimmy was right back on television on Friday night, like it never even happened. And I'm going to have a lot more to say about this when I do my SmackDown review. But let me shift over to AEW here for a little bit. The AEW All Out show on September 5th in Chicago sold out on Friday, according to the Ticketmaster website, after most of the tickets went in the presale the day before. There were about 9,500 of them. There were only about 2,000 or so tickets left for the general public on Friday, and those were gone in less than half an hour. And there are not many tickets at this point on the secondary market, so it looks like the majority actually went to real people and not bots, which is good news, but still plenty of tickets available for Dynamite and Rampage in the same building that week. I think they have outgrown the Sears Center for their big annual show, or the Now Arena, I guess it's called now. I think they could easily put 15 to 20,000 people in the United Center. Something I hope they consider for next year. You know, if they still want to do business and still want to show loyalty to the Now Center, they could always do Dynamite there. They could do Rampage there. But I would save the pay-per-view for the bigger venue. Because I don't think, you know, once a year for, again, what seems to be their big annual show, I don't think they would have much of an issue putting in that 15 to 20K range into that building. Now, AEW held its Road Rager show from Miami on Wednesday. My full video review is up on the YouTube channel. Thank you to the 1,000 or so that joined me live. The big highlight of the show was the debut of Tommy End, the former Aleister Black, now going under the name Malakai Black, which is a character that he himself came up with. This was quite the surprise. Not that he would end up in AEW, although a lot of people figured he was on his way back to WWE the minute his wife walked back out there on SmackDown, and I said, well, not so fast. He was pretty vocal on Twitch that he had no plans to go back to WWE. He was very happy in the situation that he was in, and I took him at his word. He sounded genuine. Just because one spouse goes one place doesn't mean the other one is going to follow. So the fact that he would end up in AEW to me wasn't much of a surprise. What was a surprise is that it would happen this quickly. And now we know why. He was able to circumvent the typical 90-day WWE non-compete because he didn't have the traditional WWE 90-day non-compete. It was a clerical error on the company's part when they transitioned him from NXT to the main roster. They obviously never updated the non-compete. You know, it has been said that NXT talent have 30 days, main roster talent has 90 days, where the company will continue to pay them before they can legally appear somewhere else. They don't want people to just walk straight from Raw or from SmackDown onto a competitor show. And in fact, I kind of talk about that this week in the history segment, because we get into the NWO stuff, this being the 25th anniversary and all. And if you think back to when Scott Hall and Kevin Nash left WWE, it wasn't very long. It was a matter of a few weeks before they walked out on Nitro, and it had this great impact. That's the sort of thing that WWE likes to avoid. That's why they want to put 90 days of distance between, you know, the time that somebody could appear on their programming and the time they could appear somewhere else. If your contract expires, that's a different situation. You're free to go wherever you want, whenever you want, because you're no longer under contract to the company. But if they release you early, that's where the non-compete applies. So WWE had some egg on its face this week, and you know what? I love it. I love it. It serves him right for letting him go in the first place. Now, in an interview with Fightful, Buddy Murphy shared a funny story about that. He said that he got a phone call from WWE the day after they cut him saying they messed up and his contract was only a 30-day non-compete. And if he wanted, they would extend that to 90 days for him, which he thought was a little strange given the reason they gave for firing him in the first place was budget cuts. And here they want to extend his contract. They just let go of this guy and they want to extend his contract and continue to pay him for an additional 60 days. So he thought that was a little strange. As it turns out, his contract did have the 90-day clause in it. It was not him. They thought it was him. It was not him. They panicked, he said, and they got the name mixed up. Obviously, it was Aleister Blacksteel that they were referring to. But they thought it was Murphy. And Murphy might have actually taken them up on their offer to extend the deal because he's got visa issues to worry about. You know, it's the same situation as with the Iconics where they're not from this country. They're here on a work visa. So if they don't find work within a certain period of time, you know, once their deal's officially run out, that could be a very real problem for them. So he might have actually said, you know what, yeah, I would like for you to extend my deal to the full 90 days to give me some more time to find a job somewhere. But again, he said it wasn't him. Black took to his wife's Twitch channel, Thea Trinidad's Twitch channel on Thursday to share some details about his debut, where there was a brief blackout during the Cody Rhodes QT Marshall strap match. Lights quickly came back on. Nothing really came from it. Then later on, the lights went out a second time while Arn Anderson was in the ring being interviewed by Tony Schiavone. And when they came back on, there was Black standing in the corner, getting a huge reaction. Black Mass takes down Arn. Cody comes out. Black Mass takes down Cody. Here's what he said. Once I found out that my contract was a tad different than the usual, I just came up with this idea. We made it a thing to make it available to as limited number of people as possible because that's how you keep it under wraps. Security, Cody Rhodes, and a few others. It may have been five or six total people who knew about his debut. It feels good where I'm in a place where my creative mind can be utilized instead of stopped and controlled and knowing that things were not going to work. It was the right move for me to make for me, my family, my career, the state of mind I'm in. Last night was top three, one of my favorite moments of my career. It was the culmination of months and months of having this big payoff worth the pain, chaos, and perseverance. He also said that his vision for the character is as a heel, which we pretty much knew based on what he did on Wednesday. That's something he wanted to do, he said, from the moment he debuted on NXT. He wanted to debut as a heel with this character. But Triple H saw him as a babyface, and I guess Paul Heyman as well. When Paul Heyman had influence over Raw, he was a big advocate for Aleister Black, but he saw him as being a top babyface. And so he says now he's got new gear that he's going to be debuting. He's got new entrance music coming as well. I appreciated the attention to detail with the contact lens in the one eye that was damaged during the feud between Seth Rollins and the Mysterios. The fact that he would kind of keep that going is, I don't know, I can appreciate that. I didn't really like the whole angle with him and the eye patch and all that, but the fact that he at least is keeping that consistency, I think, is kind of cool. But he's a big pickup for them. There's no doubt about it. He is a big pickup for them. This is not just, oh, another WWE guy signing with AEW. If you were going to prioritize certain ex-WWE talents that become available, he would be at or near the top of the list. And I think he will do very well. All the people I saw saying, oh, of course, his first feud is with Cody. Of course, it's Cody. I don't see what's gained from him losing to Cody. Everybody assuming he's going to lose. He is not losing to Cody. Just stop. People complain that Cody had no direction. He's been wrestling with no-name Nightmare Factory people that nobody knows. And then he gets somebody with a name to work with, and those same people still complain. This is far better than Cody Rhodes against QT Marshall. Or Cody Rhodes being slapped around by Jade Cargill. Maybe this will help give Cody some direction, something interesting to do for a change. But Black is somebody that should be protected, and his finish should be protected as well. Kind of like Omega's one-winged angel. And I hope they do that. Now, Andrade El Idolo also made his in-ring debut on Dynamite. Physically, he looks to be in the best shape of his life. He picked up an easy win over Matt Sydal. He came off like a star in the ring, but it'll just take some time. I think it's his work in the ring that's going to ultimately get him over. It's not going to be his promo work, but I think the work that he puts in the ring, and as he kind of climbs the ladder and they put him in there with some bigger names, that really is what will help get him over. Black definitely had the more impactful of the two debuts. I don't even think you can compare the two. But I thought his first match was fine. Just win. Right now with Andrade, it's all about winning. Just keep winning. And one last note here. From the show on Wednesday, the Neanderthal who hopped the barricade and tried to get into the ring to go after MJF during his segment with Chris Jericho before being tackled by security, is now on Twitter, threatening to do it again. And he tagged his idol, Jim Cornette, and his co-host, so he must be a disciple of their show. And as expected, Cornette told the fucker off and blocked him for being stupid. Because as much as Jim Cornette may not like AEW, and I saw him again on Twitter going at it with Kenny Omega, and Omega's posting stuff, he's also trying to kind of dredge stuff up. That doesn't help matters either, by the way, but there is no way that he would endorse fans jumping into the ring and attacking the wrestlers. He himself has been attacked by fans over the years. In fact, he has gone to jail for it. He is not going to encourage people to be doing stuff like that. But Cornette tweeted, "Got news for you, dipshit. The ring is sacred ground for us. And even if you and a lot of others think you can kick the shit out of the Young Bucks, I would have turned you into a tennis racket popsicle. And you're lucky somebody there didn't gut you like a fish. And you're blocked." I'm not even going to mention the guy's name. In fact, this is going to be the only mention of this I even make. I only bring this up to say that I hope Tony Khan bans this clown from all future events and puts his picture up so that if he even tries to get into any of these buildings, they bounce his ass right back into the street where he belongs. Now, this Wednesday night is night one of their Fyter Fest show from Austin, Texas, which is highlighted by the return of Jon Moxley, who will be who apparently now is going for the bald look. He just went and shaved his head, apparently, based on what little video I saw floating around on Twitter, so I guess that's his new look. But he'll be back, and he is defending his IWGP United States Championship against Carl Anderson. Got Darby Allin against Ethan Page in a coffin match. Matt Hardy one-on-one with Christian Cage. Brian Cage against Ricky Starks for the FTW title. And Penelope Ford takes on the returning Yuka Sakazaki, who stopped appearing for AEW due to the pandemic and then resurfaced as part of the women's tournament back in February, I guess it was. But she has not worked for them since, so she will be back on TV this week. And I was very sad to hear this week that Terry Funk, who just turned 77 years old and beat COVID earlier this year, has been moved into an assisted living facility. Don Morocco first talked about it on his podcast. I was today years old when I learned that Don Morocco has a podcast. But I guess I shouldn't be surprised. Everybody's got one these days. Claiming that Funk had dementia. And he may or may not have dementia. There are people, including Tommy Dreamer, who have since spoken with Funk and said he sounded good. All these reports about his mental state are overblown. But once word began to spread, a representative for Funk posted the following on his official Twitter account. Yes, Mr. Funk is currently receiving residential care for his multiple health issues, which do affect his mind as well as the rest of his body. As you can imagine, some days are better than others. He and his family appreciate all of your kind words. Forever. PW Insider confirmed that Funk has been dealing with health issues that have gotten progressively worse over the past year since his wife Vicky passed away. You know, he and his wife met when they were in high school. And they got married 2 years later in 1964. So they were married 55 years before she passed away. That is not something that you really ever get over. And there was a note in the Observer that I thought was really sad. A&E went to Funk's home to interview him for the Mick Foley biography that they did. Foley, you know, really wanted him to be part of the show. And when it aired, there was no footage of him being interviewed in the documentary, which was a bad sign. That's the one biography special I missed, too. I heard it was excellent, the Mick Foley one. I have to get around to watching it. But apparently Funk was not featured in there. But, you know, what can be said about Terry Funk? The man is a legend in every sense of the word. He has wrestled through 5 decades for promotions, big and small, all over the world. From one of the most famous wrestling families, right? Former NWA champion. Got the empty arena match in Memphis with Jerry Lawler. My eye, my eye. The feud with Ric Flair in their I Quit match in 1989. The hardcore stuff he did in the 90s in Japan with Atsushi Onita and Cactus Jack. And the contributions he made to ECW at a time when that promotion was really starting to grow. He gave them credibility just by working there. That was huge for ECW. I mean, we could try to forget about the Chainsaw Charlie days. We can kind of forget that happened. But you won't hear a bad word said about Terry Funk. He is one of the most respected names in wrestling history. Whatever it is that he may be dealing with, I know he's also been in a lot of pain with his hip, I've read. All of those years in the ring, unfortunately, they take a toll. And when the mind begins to rob you of your memories, that is just a horrible thing. Speaking of robbed, I was robbed of 3 hours of my life that I can't get back on Monday night. You know, I think that I have been more than fair to Monday Night Raw. I know some people are going to hear that and laugh. What are you talking, fair to Monday Night Raw? Yeah, I do. I think I have been fair to Monday Night Raw the last 2 weeks. I have pointed out some of the things that I liked. Last week, they toned down the Alexa Bliss stuff. I think the direction of the Eva Marie Doudrop stuff, if it plays out the way that I think it will, should get a good reaction from the live audience. Drew McIntyre, AJ Styles, and Matt Riddle had a very enjoyable main event. This week, I don't know what the hell happened, but it was just a total collapse. That was a putrid show on Monday night. And if the goal was to get people interested in Money in the Bank, it failed. At least for this person, it failed. Andrew sent a super chat, and shout out to Andrew if he's listening to this. But Andrew sent a super chat into the AEW stream I did on Wednesday night, and he said that he had to bury his grandfather that day. And Monday Night Raw was still the worst thing that happened to him this week. That is how bad this Raw show was. Last week, Raw did its third lowest viewership of all time. Just 1.57 million viewers. But they were also up against an NBA playoff game. All right, fine. Right? You want to put that in there as an excuse? Fine. This week, they finally hit rock bottom. And there was no NBA game to blame for it. Monday Night Raw scored the lowest viewership in the 28-year history of the show, dating all the way back to 1993. Just 1.47 million viewers. A well-deserved number. They should consider themselves lucky that the number was even that high. They barely beat out the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest on ESPN. That did 1.35 million the day before. Of course, out came the Brigade. Oh, it was the 4th of July. No, it wasn't. It was the 5th of July. Now we're counting the day after the holidays. Soon we'll be counting the day before the holidays. Then it'll be the holiday week. Then it'll be, oh, Solomonster, it was August. The show set a record low because it fucking sucks. That's why. There is no hidden reason. There is no scientific formula to it. There is no analysis needed. The show is as bad as it has ever been, and it is virtually unwatchable in its current state. Getting rid of the Thunderdome might help a little bit, but that's not going to solve any of the problems that this show has. You had a very lame Miz TV segment to open with some of the members of the Men's Money in the Bank match. That was a complete waste of time. Did absolutely nothing to try to get people enticed for this pay-per-view. To be honest with you, and I actually am going to have some nice things to say about the Money in the Bank match, which I think is actually setting up to be very strong. This segment, though, did nothing to get people any more excited about it. The match on its own, I think, is going to end up being very strong. But this was the usual lame Miz TV nonsense. We had a non-American badass, Jinder Mahal, riding into the building on a motorcycle, telling the backstage interviewer that when he reached out to Drew McIntyre recently to go riding together, apparently this is what they do, they go riding together, Drew took 3 days to respond to him, and when he did, he said that he was too busy. And he had the audacity to use the number 2 instead of spelling the word out. So he wanted a match with Drew McIntyre. Riveting storytelling here. Drew won their match by DQ when Mahal's men interfered, and after the match, Mahal stole Drew's sword. He stole his sword. We go from stealing crowns on Fridays to stealing swords on Mondays. What is this, medieval times? We had Charlotte Flair and Rhea Ripley. Oh, it gets better. It gets better. Their epic feud over the Raw Women's Championship in a sword fight of their own, only instead of swords, it was crutches. Charlotte came out using a crutch. She was feigning an injury. She was claiming that she might have to miss Money in the Bank after Rhea clipped her knee the week before. Rhea comes out on a crutch of her own. She's mocking Charlotte. She sees right through her, she says. She calls her a drama queen. They each went to kick each other at the same time, and they dropped their crutches, and then they picked them back up, and they started attacking each other with the crutches. They were having a crutch fight. They look like a couple of old ladies out there, trying to beat each other off with their cane. If the object of this feud is to get me to hate both of these women, then mission accomplished. This is the greatest storyline of all time. Because I cannot bring myself to care about either one of them. I can't stand either of these women. The Nikki A.S.H. stuff is just, it's pretty bad. The dialogue, oh my God. Oh my God, the dialogue was like something out of a bad video game with her and Naomi and Asuka in the back before their match. Nobody talks like this. Did you see that segment? Better yet, don't. Don't even bother. They had a segment in the back before they went out for their match. The three of them were talking. They were interacting, I think. I think this is how human beings interact. No human beings that I know. It was the three of them and Alexa Bliss against Eva Marie, Doudrop, Nia Jax, and Shayna Baszler. Nia squashed Nikki with a Samoan drop to win the match, and Eva announced herself as the winner. They teamed Jackson Ryker up with R-Truth for a win over Elias and Cedric Alexander. To show you just how creatively bankrupt these people are, they are still having Tozawa run out with the 24/7 title, being chased by the Brigade of Jobbers who chase after him for no reason. They have literally not changed the formula of this 24/7 shit for at least a full year. Either do something different with the belt or get rid of it. Just end this already. It is not funny. It is not humorous. It is not amusing. It is beyond stale. And Xavier Woods was back. He was tagging with Kofi Kingston in a win over Bobby Lashley and MVP. Of course, MVP took the losing fall to Kofi. Pretty predictable stuff, but probably the least offensive thing on the entire show. This show just fell off a cliff this week and hit about 5 rocks on the side of the mountain on the way down. They have completely given up on even trying. I'm hoping until they get back in front of live fans, but it's going to take a lot more than live crowds to fix the problems on this show. These problems were there before COVID was a thing. So, good luck. That's all I have to say. Good luck. Can you imagine what these numbers are going to look like come September when Monday Night Football is back? Can you imagine? Look at where the numbers are now. Even if they rebound a little bit in the next few weeks, because again, the crowds are back and everything, or maybe they'll get some big names back on TV heading into SummerSlam. But the numbers right now, again, I keep saying it all the time. The lows keep getting lower. I see Eric Bischoff chimed in. Oh, people need to shut up. It's the summertime. Everything is down. All of wrestling is down. But again, what they don't tell you, what they don't remind you of, is that we have four seasons, right? And summer is one of those seasons. We get it every year. But the numbers have never been this low before. The lows keep getting lower, but they conveniently ignore that fact. And now you're going to have Monday Night Football come back in September? Oh boy. Now, tomorrow night is the final Raw of the Thunderdome era, which has already been taped. Runs up against the Home Run Derby tomorrow night. With yet another match between Bobby Lashley and Xavier Woods, we have Alexa Bliss against Asuka, against Naomi, against Nikki Ash in a fatal four-way. Ricochet against John Morrison, falls count anywhere. Sheamus back in action, defending the U.S. title against Humberto Carrillo. Has Sheamus defended the championship at all since winning it? I'm talking before he even got hurt. I don't know that we've seen him defend the title once since he won it. Or at least since WrestleMania time. I could be wrong, but I can't think of one. I know he's wrestled, but I don't know that those were title matches. He did the open challenge thing for a while. Was that for the championship? I don't even remember. AJ Styles against Ivar of the Viking Raiders, and Eric goes one-on-one with Omos. And then next week, back in front of live fans, the two teams will meet for the Raw Tag Team titles. So now it's back into the Lions then, with live fans. And I'm telling you right now, if these are the types of shows they plan on producing once they are back on the road, they are going to be eaten alive. Maybe not in week one, maybe not even in week two. I expect them to bust out the big guns for the first shows back. I think fans are going to be excited just to be there. There will be a brief honeymoon period, I believe. But that honeymoon won't last long. And they had better be prepared for that. Do you know what I wasn't prepared for? One of the things that drives me nuts about Netflix is that depending on which country you live in, your access to certain shows and movies is limited. It really depends on your location. I wasn't prepared for that the first time I realized this to be true. Netflix has tens of thousands of content offerings, but you only get access to a fraction of that. Watching Netflix without using ExpressVPN is like paying for a gym membership but only being able to use the treadmill. It's like magic, except it's not. How it works is actually very simple. ExpressVPN lets you change your online location so you can control where you want Netflix to think that you're located. And with almost 100 different server locations, you can gain access to thousands of new shows. And it works with lots of other streaming services too, like BBC iPlayer and YouTube. You know, I've been an Ed O'Neill fan ever since the Married with Children days, so I've watched episodes of Modern Family on UK Netflix. A few weeks ago, I was watching Pulp Fiction on Canadian Netflix. It's like I'm traveling the world without leaving my house. I just opened the ExpressVPN app, I picked a location, I tapped one button to connect, and then I refreshed the page to access the content I wanted to watch. That's it. It was that easy. Even the most technologically challenged person can be watching their favorite show or movie in a matter of minutes. Yeah, I've heard from a couple of people on Twitter. If you follow me on there, you've seen I've retweeted a few people who have asked me, how can I watch Lucha Underground? Well, you can watch episodes of Lucha Underground for free on the Tubi TV app, but unfortunately, internationally in certain countries, you don't necessarily have access to Tubi. Well, now you do. And they were writing into me to thank me because they used the ExpressVPN code for the show to get access to Tubi so they could watch Lucha Underground. But I use ExpressVPN over other VPNs for its blazing fast speed and to stream in HD with absolutely zero buffering. It's also compatible with all my devices, so I can watch it on my phone, my laptop, or my smart TV. And even better, ExpressVPN encrypts my data, so I know my web browsing is safe and secure. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. Use my link at expressvpn.com/solomonster to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. WWE this week announced a partnership with Rolling Loud, the largest hip-hop festival in the world, to broadcast live matches in 2 weeks on the July 23rd episode of SmackDown. That show is airing live from Cleveland, but it'll be a split-site broadcast with matches also airing from Rolling Loud, Miami. Rolling Loud has events in several different cities. There's also Rolling Loud, New York, at the end of October at Citi Field, where the Mets play in Queens. Right next to Arthur Ashe Stadium, where AEW is going to be for Dynamite in September. But it is the first time that WWE is collaborating with a major music festival. And I like it. I think they should go on location like this at unique venues more often. Even though it only sounds like they're going to be broadcasting, I think, 2 matches from Miami on that show. It's the sort of thing that I think is cool. It's different. I'd like to see them do more of this. Now, WWE announced on Friday that Bayley will be out approximately 9 months due to an injury that she sustained in training. And, it's just unbelievable that here's this woman who has done a pretty good job of staying injury-free. You don't really hear about Bayley getting hurt or ever being out for an extended period of time with a major injury or anything. And it sounds like an ACL tear. WWE has not come out and said that it's an ACL injury. But Fightful says the injury was a total freak accident. It happened during the mandatory training sessions that WWE is making the talents take, I guess at the PC, as they are getting ready to go back out on the road. And that's how it happened. I guess she was rolling around with somebody and total freak thing and the injury occurred. Her knee finally buckled after carrying the show on her back all throughout the pandemic. Her knee could only take so much stress. And it sucks that just as WWE is going back out on the road in front of fans, she goes down with an injury. So if it is an ACL injury, they're saying 9 months. That makes sense. That's about how long they usually say people are going to be out for. Jimmy Uso had an ACL injury, and he ended up being out for over a year. So it could be longer. It's a serious injury. Now on SmackDown, Sonya Deville announced that Bianca Belair will no longer be defending her SmackDown Women's Championship in Money in the Bank. It was supposed to be Bianca and Bayley in an I Quit match. Instead, she will be defending her title on the first live SmackDown with fans this Friday in Houston against Carmella. And Liv Morgan was not happy about that. She got up in Sonya's face. But Deville noted that Liv would be taking Carmella's spot in the Women's Money in the Bank match. And Morgan vowed that she would win Money in the Bank and then she would cash in on Carmella if she wins the title. Which is nice and all, but it is not going to happen. Because Sasha Banks awaits. Sasha Banks awaits Bianca at SummerSlam. We had some NXT debuts here on this show. Shotzi and Knox. That's what they're calling them. Shotzi Blackheart and Tegan Knox made their debut on Friday night in a non-title match against the women's tag team champions Natty and Tamina. They're calling them Shotzi and Knox. Although Michael Cole on commentary called her Tegan Knox several times, but Shotzi is no longer Blackheart. She is just Shotzi. Now, Tegan Knox made her return at the Great American Bash this week. I'm going to have my NXT review here in a bit. So she comes out on the Great American Bash show and she basically costs Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell the NXT women's tag team titles, and she chases off Candice, who was responsible in storyline for her torn ACL, which is what kept her out for so many months. And now it's like, well, so much for Tegan and Candice on NXT. Or does that continue? I mean, we've had cases before where you'll have an NXT talent like a Kevin Owens, who was the NXT champion at the time, who debuts on the main roster but continues to appear on NXT for a few more weeks or maybe another month. So I wouldn't necessarily close the door on the possibility we could have a Tegan Candice match on NXT, but it sure sounds like this is a full-time promotion for her to the main roster. But it does seem to mean the end of the Shotzi Ember Moon tag team. And the only thing I could think of is maybe Ember Moon didn't want to get sent back down to the main roster. Things did not work out too well for her last time. If that is the case, I do not blame her at all. We also had a coming soon vignette hyping the return, or not the return, but the debut of Toni Storm. Toni Storm is SmackDown bound. She still has her first and last name until they shorten it to just Storm. And then when Marvel sends them a cease and desist, she just becomes Toni. But it's a, look, it's a necessary move. It is well past time to beef up that women's division. That women's division has been dead. Depth-wise, it has been dead. The Raw women's division is not much better. They need new blood. They need new faces. They've lost Bayley now for at least 9 months. But now, in the last few weeks, on the SmackDown side, they have added Zelina Vega. They're adding Toni Storm, Tegan Nox, and Shotzi Blackheart. And I think it's very possible that Becky Lynch may land there as well. By the way, I had been predicting a Becky against Bayley match for SummerSlam. And if I'm right, and that was the plan, they need a plan B for Becky Lynch if she is going to wrestle on that show. Plan B should be Rhea Ripley, challenging for the Raw Women's title that she never actually lost. Remember, she got pregnant. She gave the title up. She never actually lost it. There's a story there. But you just know that they would shoehorn Charlotte into the damn thing. You know this isn't over between her and Rhea and Money in the Bank. There's no way that's going to be the end of the Charlotte-Rhea stuff. But if it's up to me, Becky Lynch challenges Rhea Ripley in Vegas for the Raw Women's Championship. We had King Nakamura qualifying for Money in the Bank with a win over the broke and despondent Baron Corbin. WWE was just mercilessly mocking this poor guy for being down on his luck, losing all of his money, losing his crown, the bad investments. They were bullying him. Pat McAfee on commentary said that Corbin's hairline had committed treason to the rest of his face. I don't know if that's what he meant to say. I don't know if he meant to say that his hairline had retreated from the rest of his face. That would make more sense. I think that's what he meant. It really does look like his hairline has retreated inward. He's got that horseshoe thing going on. But he hasn't been shaving, so he had a lot of stubble on his head, so it was more noticeable, the whole horseshoe thing. But you can see where the hairline begins and where it ends. Anyway, we got the match for the 47th time. Corbin against Nakamura. Nakamura won. He is in the Money in the Bank match. And Baron Corbin remains down on his luck. Will the fans actually cheer for Baron Corbin? That remains to be seen. They're going with the sympathy angle. Can they actually get people to cheer for Baron Corbin? Happy Corbin is coming. It has already been trademarked. Happy Corbin is on the way. I think it might actually work. I think he could pull this off. Again, I'm mildly invested in this because it has been so long that we have seen Baron Corbin as the fucking king that doing something different with him and kind of flipping him from heel to babyface, I'm very curious to see if the people take to him as a babyface. Seth Rollins beats Cesaro to become the final man to punch his ticket to the men's Money in the Bank ladder match. Got a lot of sad faces in my Twitter replies for Cesaro. Got a couple of angry emails from people, angry at the treatment of Cesaro. And all I can say, and I like Cesaro, but all I can say is I don't know what you guys were expecting. If you listen to this podcast, I told you months ago This was not going to last but a few months. He got his championship match with Roman Reigns. He got a big win over Rollins at WrestleMania, but he got his championship match with Roman Reigns. That was very good. He got his shot. They've dragged out the program with Rollins longer than even I thought they would, but this was always going to be the end result. They don't see Cesaro as a top-of-the-card performer. Just because they put him in some big matches over the span of 2 or 3 months does not mean that is how they see him. You know how I know this? Because I've been watching the shows for the 10 years or so, or 11 years that he has been on the main roster. And in the decade that he has been on television, he has been slotted as a middle-of-the-card performer, primarily locked into the tag team division. They put him with like 4 or 5 different partners in his career. And he has excelled in every role, whether it was the team with Jack Swagger, whether it was the team with Sheamus, whether it was the team with Tyson Kidd. I think I'm missing somebody. But that is where they see him. Daniel Bryan is probably the one who got him this big push in the first place when Bryan had some influence creatively behind the scenes on SmackDown. That's why Bryan was working with him. And guess what? Daniel Bryan is gone right now. He is gone. This was always going to be temporary. And now he will settle back to where he was before. He's as a good utility man on the roster. And that is a spot that apparently he is content to be in. Frankly, the story works better with Seth Rollins going to Money in the Bank anyway. If it were up to me, I would have had Rollins win too. That does not mean Cesaro was buried. He got busted open during the match. He fought valiantly. But he was never going to go beyond the point that he has already gone to. He's already been to the promised land. That's as good as it gets for him. But the story here works better with Rollins being in the match. I can play up the fact that he once won Money in the Bank and he cashed in at WrestleMania. Could he do it again? Rollins and Money in the Bank makes the match better. I have to give them credit. They have gone out of their way to put together one hell of a field for this men's Money in the Bank match. We've got Drew McIntyre, Matt Riddle, Ricochet, John Morrison, all representing Raw. And we've got Seth Rollins, Big E, Shinsuke Nakamura, and Kevin Owens representing SmackDown. Very babyface heavy this year. Hopefully they won't waste the briefcase like they did last year on Otis. Although if it was the Otis of today, that would have been a hell of a Money in the Bank pick. I love what they're doing with Otis right now. This guy's all business. But the big story on this show had to do with the Samoan family being reunited. Jimmy Uso was on the show this week. You would never even know that he had a very eventful week behind the scenes. His brother Jay, who's been off television now for several weeks, he was back. Roman said the family is back together. He gave them the hug. I don't know if they were going for this specifically, but it reminded me of the Bret Hart moment when he hugged Owen and Davey Boy years ago and formed the Hart Foundation, and the camera zoomed in on his face. And he had this very devious, mischievous look on his face. Roman had a similar type of look. The family is back together. And Roman Reigns was out to confront Edge at the very end of the show. The Usos, fearing that it was a trap, they came out to aid Roman, even though Roman told them, stay in the back, I don't want your help. We had the return of Rey and Dominic Mysterio. They came back with chairs in hand, attacking the Usos. Edge put the crossface with the metal bar from the chair, like what he did to Roman and what he did to Jimmy. He did the same thing to Jay. He did it again to Jimmy. All while Roman was watching from the stage. He watched on as his cousins were abused in the ring by Edge. And it looked like they might be setting up for a 6-man tag. It is now official this Friday on SmackDown. It will be Roman Reigns and the Usos against Edge, Rey Mysterio, and Dominic. So business as usual with Jimmy. Did not even miss a single week of TV. I can only say this. I hope they are addressing things in private. Because it is not enough for me to go online and read these stories I see from Fightful or WrestleVotes and other places saying the WWE officials are privately very upset and very disappointed at the highest levels of WWE. They're very upset and they're very disappointed with Jimmy Uso. It's not enough for me to read that and then simply have them move on and pretend like there isn't a problem here. I hope they are addressing things with him quietly. We just don't know about it. And that this guy gets himself straight. Because as great as the Usos are, and as great as it would be to see them against the Mysterios for the tag team titles at SummerSlam, this is more important than a fucking wrestling match. And like I said last week, before Jimmy even got arrested, what did I say in the podcast last week on 7-Eleven? I would prefer to see WWE give the match to Otis and Chad Gable instead and give them a run with the belts. The Usos, you know what? They don't even need it right now. So if they wanted to do Chad, Gable, and Otis against the Mysterios at SummerSlam, cool. I'm fine with that match. They don't need Jimmy Uso on TV right now. I know it's a pain in the ass. I know it throws a little bit of a monkey wrench in this whole storyline because you want to have both Usos and not just one, but they don't need him. They could write him off very easily this Friday. They could have them lose. Roman could blame him for the loss. I thought they were going to shoot an angle at the end of the show where Jimmy was going to get ambushed. I thought they were going to have Jay turn on Jimmy at the request of Roman, and that was how they were going to write him out of the storyline and off of television. I was surprised that they didn't do that. Maybe they'll do it on Friday. WWE has fired people or punished them for far less than what Jimmy Uso did. RVD got busted with weed, and he lost 2 championships in 2 days and got suspended. You're going to tell me that there's no preferential treatment going on here? Preferential is not the kind of treatment that Jimmy Uso needs. Now, as we bring this Thunderdome era to a close, I thought I would say a few words about it here. You know, Vince McMahon has invested a lot of money, millions of dollars, for his virtual wall of fans. I would rather have had the Thunderdome than just empty black space and wrestlers performing in silence. It's one of the reasons why when I would occasionally flip on Impact Wrestling, I quickly turned it off. I couldn't watch it. Only recently, really, did they start with like the background noise, and I guess they're going to be getting fans back in the building soon. So I would much rather have something like the Thunderdome than not have anything at all. And I could appreciate the effort that went into putting all of that together. It is a huge undertaking. There were a lot of people working on that, putting it together, making that thing work. But it is not the way the wrestling was meant to be watched. And I will also say this to all of the people saying bye-bye piped-in crowd chants. I saw a lot of that sentiment this week. Oh my God, I can't wait until we get rid of the fake crowd chants. Oh, we're not going to miss you. What makes you think that this is the end of the piped-in fake crowd noise? Why does everybody seem to think that just because the Thunderdome is going away and they're going to be back in front of live crowds, that they're not going to be still piping in the same shit they've been doing for months? I don't believe for a second that they're totally doing away with the pumped-in crowd noise. That's their baby now. That's going to be one of their biggest takeaways from this whole COVID era. They had 20,000 people in the building both nights of WrestleMania, and they still piped in fake crowd noise. You could hear it. I hate to break it to you, but the fake chants are here to stay. They may not use them on every show, but they're not going anywhere. That being said, I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge a few of the standout moments of the pandemic era in WWE, which will go down as the worst era in WWE history. If you were to rank all of the eras, the Golden Era, the New Generation Era, the Attitude Era, Ruthless Aggression, the PG Era, we now have the COVID Era. And it trumps all of the other eras, even the ones with the Goon and TL Hopper and the Triple H Reign of Terror. It trumps them all as the worst era in company history. Monday Night Raw has never been worse. And wrestling in front of no fans and then in front of virtual fans is awful. And yet, despite this, there were a few positive things that stand out to me. For one, some of the promo work that we have been able to see on TV, even going back to the empty Performance Center shows, and actually those are the shows more than any that stand out to me. There was very little I liked about those shows. But the promo work is something that still stands out to me, especially from people like Edge. And then later on, you had Roman Reigns, once he came back, Rey Mysterio. There were certain episodes and storylines where guys were able to really shine and really pump out some stellar promo work. You could even go back to WrestleMania this year when they had the rain delay at the beginning of the show. They had a scramble to kill time, basically. We got to see from people like Kevin Owens and Drew McIntyre and others how they responded to a situation like that without a script to memorize or without even bullet points. They just put a microphone in their face and said, here, we need you to talk for 3 minutes. And not in every case, but in a lot of cases, I thought they thrived and it was better than anything they could have scripted for these people. But the best part about the promo work during this era, the absolute best part about it, no stupid what chance to interrupt them. That I am going to miss. We had the Boneyard match last year, WrestleMania 36, right at the beginning of the pandemic. A fine send-off for The Undertaker, one of my favorite matches all year. That's a cinematic-style match done right. And if that ends up being The Undertaker's last match, and I'm still skeptical, as of now, it is his final match, but we know how that goes. I thought it would be a fine send-off for him. Bayley, I just talked about her and her injury. Her character work and her segments with Sasha Banks from when they held the women's tag team titles, and all the titles, really, straight on through their feud and their Hell in a Cell match for the SmackDown women's title, probably my favorite match, you know, in-ring match, not cinematic match, of the COVID era, was their Hell in a Cell bout. And their segments, by the way, did well. They had a title match on SmackDown in November that, as I recall, was a ratings draw for the company. It did over 2.5 million viewers, which was the most watched WWE segment since the beginning of the pandemic in March. So almost everything that Bayley was doing was gold, especially when she was ragging on Michael Cole. But her character work really came along in a big way during this era. She was one of the few people who really benefited, I think, from this whole situation. She was one of the MVPs of this era. And speaking of MVP, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Hurt Business with Bobby Lashley, Cedric Alexander, Shelton Benjamin, and MVP. A group that was broken up prematurely for no good reason far too soon. But putting MVP together with Lashley, or I should say reuniting them from their days together in Impact Wrestling, and the rise of Lashley the Destroyer, who they protected more than anybody else not named Roman Reigns, when he was the United States Champion, they did a hell of a job of protecting this guy and really building him up before finally winning his first WWE Championship in March. And that was very cool to see him finally ascend to that level because he was booked as a destroyer, because he was booked in a believable way. And of course, the heel turn that we waited years for with Roman Reigns and the rise of the tribal chief. And my only regret is that it didn't happen in front of live fans. You have a big heel turn like that. You have a guy as polarizing as Roman was. Imagine the reactions. Imagine the crowd reactions when he first came back and he was aligned with Paul Heyman and he was healing on everybody. But Roman Reigns has been carrying this company now for months. He's doing the best work of his career. The way he carries himself, the way Paul Heyman walks on eggshells when he's around him, the new music, the quality matches that he has had with Jey Uso and with Drew McIntyre at Survivor Series, with Kevin Owens, with Edge and Daniel Bryan, with Cesaro. It took WWE far too long to figure it out and get it right, but now they have. Better late than never. Now he is the star that Vince McMahon always wanted him to be. It was the Great American Bash on NXT this week. They had the Statue of Liberty head as part of the set and the torch. Lady Liberty's, not Wade Keller's. And they brought back the red, white, and blue ring robes, which would explain why they didn't use them for a takeover in your house. So that was nice to see. MSK retained their NXT tag team titles over Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher in the opener. Only went about 11 minutes, which surprised me. I thought it would go a little bit longer, unless they're going to run it back again at the next takeover show. And they're going to just go balls out there. Wesley rolling up Thatcher with a cradle for the win. That would seem to indicate that probably is where this thing is headed. That was hardly a decisive kind of put a stamp on it, this feud is over kind of finish. This was good stuff, but I would have put the titles on Ciampa and Thatcher and had MSK chase to get them back. You know, MSK was actually getting boos from the crowd, and I think part of it is that people just really wanted to see Ciampa win because they like him. But this is not an isolated incident. Not the first time we've heard boos for MSK in the CWC. I think there are some fans who think it's too much too soon and that they should have struggled for a bit before getting the belts. That's why I wouldn't have put the belts on them in the first place. I wouldn't have put them on them so soon. I think that's where some of this backlash is coming from. Johnny Gargano and Karrion Kross had a face-to-face where William Regal announced that the two of them are going to meet this Tuesday for the NXT Championship, and Samoa Joe will serve as the guest referee. And Joe said that so long as he is not provoked, everything should run smoothly. Do you think it's going to run smoothly? I don't think it's going to run smoothly. See, I really want to believe that Joe is secretly cleared, and when he inevitably gets touched or he gets into it with Cross this week, we get Cross and Joe for the title at TakeOver next month, with Joe winning the championship and sending Cross off to his doom on the main roster. I want to believe that. I don't know if it's true, but I want to believe that. Cross flat out said during the segment he's got three goals when he wakes up every morning. He wants to remain the NXT champion, he wants to main event WrestleMania, and he wants to become WWE champion. I mean, if I was with someone like Scarlett, I would say that she's on my list of goals every morning too. But I guess he was keeping this limited to just his career goals. And that, coupled with all the dark matches and the main event matches that he's been getting lately, I don't mean main event matches, I mean matches on main event, he's totally being drafted after SummerSlam. I believe that 100%. He's gone. Karrion Kross is as good as gone. So the one good thing about this is that any title match that he is in now, you can believe that he might actually lose the title. I still don't see Johnny Gargano being the one to win it from him, but you can believe that it's possible. With a lot of cheating, but it's possible. Because he does not feel long for this brand. But even though Gargano is still acting like a heel, I expect him to be cheered like a babyface against Cross this week. By the way, there was a tweet, and I can't remember if it was the WWE on Fox account or it was some other account of theirs that tweeted it, asking which star people most associate with NXT. Like, who do you think is Mr. NXT? And for me, it would be Johnny Gargano. I see him as Mr. NXT, if for no other reason, because he's been involved in what I think are the two greatest matches in NXT history. Both of which were for the NXT Championship. His takeover match with Andrade Cien Almas, and his takeover New York match with Adam Cole when he won the title. So for that reason alone, Gargano would get my vote. LA Knight beat Cameron Grimes. I thought this was enjoyable. The $1 million belt had fallen out of the ring when Knight reached for it. And then later when they were on the floor, he gave Grimes a DDT onto the belt. And they teased a count out until Grimes got back into the ring at 9.999. Knight then finished things off with his headlock DDT. And per the stipulation, Cameron Grimes now must become Knight's butler. He now becomes his Virgil. And it's perfect. It gets sympathy on Grimes for all of the humiliating shit that LA Knight is going to force him to do until they meet again, probably at TakeOver next month, and Grimes finally gets the big babyface win. It's perfect. They introduced us to the eight men in this year's breakout tournament, which begins this Tuesday. Trey Baxter, Carmelo Hayes, who is my pick to win. This guy's got all the tools from what I've seen of him so far. looks the part. He's my pick. Andre Chase, Josh Briggs, Ikemen Jiro, Joe Gacy, Duke Hudson, and Odyssey Jones. He's the 400-pounder I mentioned who broke the deadlift record at the NXT Combine 2 years ago at 800 pounds. The guy looks massive. Big guy. It's probably why he got a dark match before SmackDown against Bobby Roode last week. Vince McMahon had to excuse himself to the men's room after he watched his match. But if Duke Hudson looked familiar, he is the former Brendan Vink, who spent a hot minute on Raw last year. Those early pandemic shows, he was managed by MVP. He was tagging with Shane Thorne, and then they just disappeared after 2 weeks. So from Monday Night Raw back to NXT in a breakout tournament. That is an unusual path, I would say. We have new NXT Women's Tag Team Champions with Io Shirai and Zoe Stark taking the titles from Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell. The lights went out during the match. We had the battery indicator flashing on the Tron, the one we've been seeing on television for weeks now. It went from 99% to 100%, worst battery ever. Took 4 weeks to charge. When the lights came on, there was Tegan Nox, standing on the stage nearly 10 months after we last saw her on television being attacked by Candice. She had surgery for her third ACL tear in 4 years. Three ACL tears, and she's only 26 years old. I mean, I wish her well, and I hope that she can put her knee problems behind her, but that's not good. And when she went after Candice here, I was worried she was going to hurt herself again. I suspect that I'll be feeling that way when I watch all of her matches. I was feeling the same way watching her on SmackDown on Friday night. Every time she landed on her knee or she hit some kind of move, I winced. It's all I can think about now is how her knee is made of silly putty. But after she chased off Candice, that left Indy all by herself, and Zoe Stark finished her off with her Tilt-A-Whirl GTS to win the titles. They are all in on Zoe Stark. She has been pushed hard from the moment she debuted on this show. They clearly have very high hopes for her. And in theory, the title win here keeps Io Shirai around NXT for a little while longer. But you know, I look at it and I go, well, you know, there's over a month to go before this rumored draft they're going to be doing. So she is still not safe. I still do not consider Io Shirai to be safe. She must be protected at all costs. During the commercial break, they showed us on the flip side, Dexter Lumis came down. He carried Hartwell to the back while Beth Phoenix lost her mind. She was hysterical with glee. We got a live rap concert with the members of Hit Row celebrating Swerve Scott's North American title win over Bronson Reed. I like this a lot. We had Ashanti the Adonis serving as the DJ while Top Dolla and B-Fab and Swerve all took turns singing. I thought the presentation here was fantastic. I hope when Vince McMahon visited the Performance Center last week, these four locked themselves in another room and held their breath and stood really, really still until he left. It's like something out of a horror movie. Remember when Jamie Lee Curtis went into the closet to get away from Michael Myers and she crouched down and she tried to be quiet so he wouldn't know where she was? I hope that was Hit Row last week at the PC when Vince McMahon came by for a visit. And Adam Cole vanquished Kyle O'Reilly in the main event. A very different match than the unsanctioned match they had at TakeOver Stand and Deliver, which O'Reilly won. This was a straight wrestling match, a very good one. With Cole's win, that evens them up, I presume, for one final rubber match. But I gotta be honest with you, I'm over it. I'm done. I've gotten my fill of Adam Cole against Kyle O'Reilly. I am ready for them to move on to something else. I don't think we even need to see one more match. O'Reilly had come off the top with his bombs away knee drop. Cole, though, rolled out of the way. And Cole followed that up with the last shot. O'Reilly kicked out at the last possible moment. And Cole went for the Panama Sunrise. O'Reilly blocked it with a knee strike, but the dummy used the same knee that Cole was working over during the match. What an idiot. So Cole tried again, and this time he hit the move before connecting with one last final shot for the win. It was a great wrestling match, but I have seen enough from these two. And for Adam Cole, the only place for him to go would be to challenge either Karrion Kross or Johnny Gargano if he were to win for the NXT Championship. And presumably it'll be Kross at the next TakeOver show, because what else do you do with Adam Cole if you don't do the match with O'Reilly? I guess they probably will do the match with O'Reilly, but if you don't, if this really is it, it's really the only thing left for Adam Cole to do. So I thought this was a strong show. Very good NXT this week. We have an NXT Championship match coming up with Samoa Joe as the referee on Tuesday. So I'm looking forward to that. But good stuff from NXT this past week.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 36 years ago this week on July 6th, 1985, Tito Santana and Greg the Hammer Valentine's feud over the Intercontinental title culminated in a steel cage match in Baltimore. Tito had won the title the year before from Don Morocco and held it for 226 days before dropping it to Valentine, who himself held the title for 285 days before dropping it back to Santana here, the first WWE championship to change hands inside a steel cage. After the match, Valentine, the sore loser that he is, swung the title belt around inside the cage. He was whipping it against the steel. He was trying to destroy the belt until Tito climbed back inside to chase him out. And with Valentine destroying the title, they had a new one made shortly after, which was the classic IC title design that I grew up on, that they used until 1998, and then brought back again many years later because it was far superior to what they were using. I used to joke with people. I said, you know, if the title design that they were using up until 98 was, you know, not as good as the ones they were using recently, then why'd they go back to it? Because it's better. That's why. As most of the title designs from back then were. So I was very happy when they resurrected it. But when Santana was asked what he did with the old belt, he claims that he threw it in the garbage that night in Baltimore. Now, Greg Valentine tells a different story. He says, one day when I saw Tito a few years ago, I asked whatever became of that belt, because Tito kept it after that angle. He told me that his wife threw it out. Do you know how much money I could have made with that belt now? So it looks like Tito Santana's wife, she's got some heat with Greg Valentine. Well, you know, he's not wrong. And I'm sure WWE would have offered him $1,000 for it, like they did that pair of boots that Valentine sold him on their Most Wanted Treasure show on A&E. Because they underpay everybody on there. 31 years ago this week, on July 6, 1990, WCW presented the Great American Bash from Baltimore. Look at that, another Baltimore show. Featuring Sting's first world championship win over Ric Flair in a match that was supposed to take place months earlier at WrestleWar, but Sting tore his knee up trying to climb up a cage after Flair on a Clash of the Champions special. Sting had aligned with the Horsemen when they went babyface, and when he became the number one contender to Flair's title and refused to surrender his title shot, the Horsemen turned on him. And that was the same night that he injured his knee. WCW went with Lex Luger to replace Sting against Flair at WrestleWar, and Jim Herd wanted Flair to drop the title to Luger, but Flair was adamant that he had promised Sting that he would drop the championship to him once he was all healed up, and so he refused. And this is really where the issues began between Flair and Herd, over a year before he fired Flair from WCW. But Flair kept his word. And when Sting came back, he did the honors for him. This show also featured the WCW debut of Big Van Vader, who at the time was the IWGP Heavyweight Champion, getting a quick squash win over Tom Zenk, the Z-Man. He would not appear again for WCW for another 7 months, and once he signed with them full-time, that's when they put Harley Race with him as his manager. And Lex Luger retained his NWA United States Championship over Mean Mark Callis, who wrestled the match with a dislocated hip in one of his final WCW appearances before debuting as The Undertaker for Vince McMahon only a few months later. This, after Ole Anderson famously told him, "No one is ever going to pay money to see you wrestle." Welp. Ole may have been a smart guy in some ways, but yeah, he missed the ball on that one. 27 years ago this week, on July 5th, 1994, jury selection began in New York in the Vince McMahon steroid trial, which is set to be covered later this year in the second half of Dark Side of the Ring Season 3. McMahon was indicted by the U.S. Justice Department in November of 93 on two counts of steroid distribution and one count of conspiracy to distribute steroids. Actually, they brought six counts against him, but three of them were thrown out, and these were the three that stuck. This after Dr. George Zahorian was convicted on 12 counts of distributing and selling steroids in 1991 to dozens of wrestlers and other athletes, too, not just wrestlers, bodybuilders, and the like. Basically, he was accused, this is Vince, he was accused of possessing steroids with the intent to distribute them to a WWF performer for non-medicinal purposes on two specific occasions. That performer was believed to have been Hulk Hogan, and also charged with trying to then cover up the use of steroids by his performers so that they could continue using them. In his opening statement, the prosecutor, Sean O'Shea, said that steroids were distributed like candy to WWF performers by the Good Doctor, and that McMahon and Titan Sports employees then engaged in an elaborate money laundering scheme to hide the purchases they had made from Zahorian. Out of a pool of around 100 jurors, 35 were excluded for some sort of bias, conflict, for reasons that included being a fan of the WWF product and they didn't want to do harm to the company. You also had non-wrestling fans who said wrestling being a work could somehow affect their judgment in the case. Or some even had relatives who worked for the same pharmacy that Dr. Zahorian used. I tried to come up with an excuse for getting out of my grand jury duty a few years ago, but they were not having any of it. I suspect that they get a lot of that. You get a lot of people who say things to try to get out of it. They're hip to it now. It will not work. More than likely, it will not work. At least it didn't for me. But when some jurors commented that they thought the trial might be fake, this really happened. They thought the trial might be fake because pro wrestling was. This is how the judge responded. "Do not question whether wrestling is sports or entertainment. It's not whether wrestling is pure entertainment or sport. The only issue at stake is the case of distribution, and to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. This is the substance, not whether wrestling is phony or sports or entertainment." In all, the prosecution called 11 wrestlers to testify against McMahon, but only one of them testified that Vince ordered them to ever use steroids, that being Kevin Wacholes, who played Nails on TV, the same Nails who physically assaulted McMahon backstage at an event over his payoff for the SummerSlam show at Wembley Stadium, and freely admitted here in court that he hated Vince McMahon. So not exactly the most reliable witness. If convicted, Vince McMahon could have faced up to 11 years in prison, over $1 million in fines. The trial only lasted a few weeks, and I will be covering the finish to it, the big finish, in the weeks to come. Just days later, on the July 11th episode of Monday Night Raw, taped on July 1st from the Fernwood Resort in Bushkill, Pennsylvania, Bret Hart defended the WWE Championship against the 1-2-3 Kid in one of the greatest matches in Raw history. Sean Waltman speaks fondly of this match and what Bret did to help get him over. This was a fantastic match. One of my favorites. I cannot recommend it enough. 25 years ago this week, on July 7th, 1996, this is the big one this week, the wrestling world changed forever with the most shocking heel turn in wrestling history. And the turning point for WCW as Hulk Hogan linked up with Scott Hall and Kevin Nash to form the New World Order at WCW's Bash at the Beach from Daytona Beach, Florida. I was not watching the pay-per-view live. I was a WWF guy. So, yeah, I would flip around between Raw and Nitro. But I wasn't paying for the WCW pay-per-views. But I remember hearing about what happened later that night, and I was floored. You know, because I grew up a Hulk Hogan fan. Hogan, Savage, you know, Piper, Jake, Perfect, later on, Demolition, The Hearts. These are all of the names, Andre DiBiase, that got me into wrestling. That was from my era. So I grew up on all that stuff, and Hulk Hogan was always the quintessential babyface. So it was shocking to find out that he would have turned heel. I cannot overstate how big of a deal this was at the time. The only thing I think that could have come closest to the Hogan heel turn, you know, in more recent times, would have been John Cena turning heel sometime around 2011 or 2012. And that's if it was done correctly for Maximum Impact. Big if, given the people who book these shows these days and write these television shows. But even then, you know, even if it was done exactly, you know, the right way, it still would not have had the kind of impact that the NWO angle had on WCW at the time. You know, they were in competition with WWE, and this stuff single-handedly turned the tide for them. There has not been anything comparable in the wrestling world since then. And, you know, these days, we know too much. We're too connected through social media. And wrestling is treated like, you know, it's treated like theater these days compared to how it used to be. You know, now it's treated more like a play than something that's treated in a serious way. I'm surprised we don't have credits rolling at the end of every show. And everybody coming out like a Broadway play to take a bow at the end of the night. But when Scott Hall debuted on Nitro, it was so well done. There were people believing that maybe he really was there invading on behalf of WWE. And then when Kevin Nash showed up and you had two of Vince McMahon's biggest stars walk out, just walked right off WWF television, right onto WCW TV weeks later. That got a lot of people interested in where things were going. Now you can understand why WWE loves their 90-day non-competes. You know, I don't know if those guys had some kind of non-compete, but it wasn't long after their contracts were over, and there they were, on Nitro, fresh off Vince's programming. And it got a lot of people interested. And to his credit, Eric Bischoff, he milked the announcement of the third man into pay-per-view buys for this Bash at the Beach show, which was a two-match show. I mean, the undercard is so underwhelming and unimportant compared to what happened at the end. But I will say, having gone back and watched it, the opener of this show with Rey Mysterio and Psicosis was fucking fantastic. One of the best openers to a pay-per-view that you will ever see. Just watch the opening match and the closing match, and that's really all you need. But the genesis of the NWO idea is actually rooted in something that Eric Bischoff saw in New Japan Pro Wrestling. You know, there have been plenty of invasion angles in wrestling, even before the NWO, you know, other countries and stuff. But in Japan, at the time, you had the UWFI, which was basically a shoot-style wrestling promotion. They entered into an agreement to work with New Japan. And a lot of the UWFI stars lost to the New Japan stars, except for one very important match, where Takada, who was, you know, their main guy, representing UWFI, or one of their main guys, defeated the Great Muta, Keiji Muto, to win the IWGP Heavyweight title. And this was a big deal, to have a non-New Japan star walk in and win their championship. And then months later, in fact, it was the month before Scott Hall walked out on Nitro, Takada defended the title at the Tokyo Dome against Shinya Hashimoto. And guess who was in attendance that night at the show? Eric Bischoff. So he got a firsthand view into this working relationship, into this, you know, invasion of sorts. And on Talk is Jericho last year, Bischoff had this to say about the Japanese influence on the NWO concept. I was spending a lot of time over there. I was studying what was working in Japan, because the business at New Japan in 93, 94, they were hot as hell. They were putting 60, 80,000 people, 100,000, well, he's exaggerating now, in the Tokyo Dome for the big shows. And here in the U.S., WWF at the time and WCW were really having a hard time in the live event side of things. So to sum it up, I was over there kind of studying what worked and the differences between the way the product was presented in Japan and here in the States. And one of the things I noticed is that it was so much more real there. The storylines, the characters, the action in the ring was more reality-based. And here in the States, it was more character, kind of comedy cartoonish. And in studying it, I was kind of watching the intercompany wars and that kind of thing, and that's where the idea started. Hall and Nash told Bischoff to get three WCW guys together, and they would get a third man of their own for a six-man tag at Bash at the Beach. WCW chose Sting, Randy Savage, and Lex Luger. Luger's name was the most talked about as, you know, possibly turning on WCW. Luger's going to be the third man. Even during the match, you know, Luger got taken out early. And I'm sure there were a lot of people who thought he'd be coming back out later in the night as the third man. Because Hall and Nash, when that match started, they started it without the third guy. It was two against three. So they kept people thinking and wondering and waiting right up until the very end who this third man was going to be. You know, the Luger turn would have been predictable. Bret Hart would have been a great choice. He was on break from WWE at that time. He had not been on television since the Iron Man match with Shawn Michaels. He was one of the company's biggest names. But even Bret, even though Bret would have been a good choice, he still would not have had the impact that Hogan did. I mean, to be fair, nobody would have. But they had sent feelers out to Bret. He had turned them down. There is this story out there that Dave Meltzer had predicted in The Observer that Mabel would be the third man, which is actually not what he said. He reported that Mabel's name had been discussed as the third man. Mabel was one of many names to be discussed. Not that he actually would be the third man. He also mentioned Crush was another name that was discussed. And that would have sucked. Can you imagine? Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and fucking Crush. But the following week in the newsletter, Meltzer said he expected it to be Hogan. But I guess it makes for a better story to claim that he said it would be Mabel. So I have to defend him on that, because that's actually not what he said in the newsletter. But Hogan had been off WCW television for a few months by this point. He was filming a movie. And he was not committed to be on every show anyway. So he was off filming some kind of movie. And, you know, he had dipped his toe in the heel waters the year before while he was feuding with the Dungeon of Doom. He went through this period where he ditched the red and yellow. He was dressed in all black. I think that was a little experiment to see how the people would respond to it. But it took some convincing by Bischoff to get Hogan to even consider turning heel. And being the third man, even though a lot of people had soured on Hogan and they were bored of him, he was still their biggest babyface. And, you know, business-wise, he still had an impact on pay-per-view buys, on ticket sales, maybe not as much as he used to. But it was a risk. It was a risk for the company and it was a risk for Hogan. Bischoff talked to Sports Illustrated for a 25th anniversary story on the NWO recently. He said, I had approached Hulk a little under a year earlier about turning heel and changing the direction of his character. He was not interested. During the next few months, it became a little more obvious to Hulk that the red and yellow guy from the 80s wasn't working anymore. He knew it, I knew it, the fans knew it. But it took a few more months for him to realize it enough to make that change. Since Hulk had previously expressed that he wasn't interested, I approached Sting about being the third man. There are a lot of reasons why I have so much respect for Steve Borden, but one of the biggest reasons is, and I remember specifically talking to him on the phone while Hogan was off doing a movie. I asked Sting to abandon the babyface position he was in and take on that heel role, which was a big ask, and Sting was willing to do it. Kevin Nash and Scott Hall did not know who the third guy was going to be. Sting and I were the only two people who knew. That's when I got a phone call from Hulk, who was literally on location filming in the middle of some mountain range in California. He said, "Hey, brother, I'd like to talk to you about what's going on. Can you make it out to California?" I said, "Sure, I'll come out." And I came to his trailer, which was basically his dressing room and his office. We had a 12-pack of beer on ice and a couple of Cuban cigars. We sat down, cracked a beer, lit a cigar, and he looked at me and asked, "Who's the third guy?" And I said, "I don't know, Hulk. Who do you think it should be?" And Hogan said, "Well, I think it should be me." At the time, Hulk never knew it was going to be Sting. That's how much of a secret that was. I wasn't 100% sure that Hulk was going to follow through until he literally showed up to the building. I was nervous as hell right up until he showed up and said, "Let's do this, brother." And so out came Hogan, late in the match with everybody down and the crowd comes alive. Dusty Rhodes is fanboying on commentary. And Bobby Heenan goes, "Yeah, but whose side is he on?" And this has greatly irritated people that he would have said this and spoiled the big swerve. He didn't spoil it, and it did make sense for Heenan to say such a thing because he spent his entire career heeling on Hogan, going back to the AWA, and trying to tell people that he was a fraud, he was a phony. But I will say, I wish he would not have said it, because it planted that seed of doubt for some people. Not everybody, but it did plant that seed of doubt for people who maybe the thought just, they couldn't conceive of it. They hadn't even thought of it as he was walking to the ring, and then Heenan says it, and now in those 10 seconds or 15 seconds before he does the big turn, you've planted that idea in their head, and now they're at least thinking about it. Bischoff said it's like sitting at the World Series of Poker, knowing that you've got the best hand and accidentally showing your cards. He said he was disappointed when Bobby blurted that out. And I've got to agree with Eric on this one. I'm the biggest Bobby Heenan fan there is. But out comes Hogan. Hall and Nash clear out to the floor. And Hogan drops the big leg on Randy Savage. And then he drops a second one. He gets a visual pin. The match actually ended in a no contest. Any other time, this would be a sin to end a pay-per-view main event with no winner like this. But in this case, you can make an exception, given the big angle at the end. You have an angry, mean Gene Okerlund climbing into the ring to conduct an interview with the turncoat from Tampa. Garbage is flying everywhere. Gene got hit in the face by something, like a bottle. The ring is just littered with debris. This is a sight to see. People were pissed. A fan got into the ring. Nash put him down with a right hand. Hall stomped on his head. Good. He should have stomped harder. This is edited out of the network version, by the way. So the only way you could see this is probably if you have the original VHS. But you will not find it on Peacock. You will not find it. It was off the network long before Peacock. But you definitely won't find it on that version now. But it shows how hot people were over this turn. And look, it got a lot of cheers, too. Hall and Nash were getting some cheers even before Hogan came out. So it wasn't 100% heel heat. But the heel heat that they got was intense. And then came one of the most memorable promos in wrestling history, where Hogan dubbed it the New World Order of Wrestling for the first time. He says, "These two men have come here from a great big organization up north, and everybody was wondering who the third man was. Well, who knows more about that organization than me, brother? I made that organization a monster. I made the people up there rich. And when it all came to time to pass, the name Hulk Hogan, the man Hulk Hogan, got bigger than the whole organization. As far as I'm concerned, all this crap in the ring represents these fans out here. For 2 years, brother, for 2 years, I held my head high. I did everything for the charities. I did everything for the kids. And the reception I got when I came out here, you fans can stick it. Because if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, you people wouldn't be here. If it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff would still be selling meat out of a truck in Minneapolis. By the way, Bischoff was a sales manager for a food processor, but he never actually sold meat off a truck. Says, if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, all these Johnny-come-latelys you see out here, wrestling wouldn't be here. I was selling the world, brother, while they were bumming gas to put in their car to get to high school. So the way it is now, brother, when Hulk Hogan and the New World Organization of Wrestling and the new blood by my side, what you gonna do when the New World Organization runs wild on you? Well, he did botch the name. I don't think New World Organization would have worked as well. Tony Schiavone had a great sign-off to the pay-per-view. He said, we have seen the end of Hulkamania. For Bobby the Brain Heenan, for Dusty Rhodes, I'm Tony Schiavone. Hulk Hogan, you can go to hell. We're out of here. Straight to hell. And he slammed his headset down. Schiavone said, when I walked backstage after the show, I passed Brian Knobbs, who is a friend of Hogan. He looked at me and said, Hulk Hogan, you can go to hell. That was fucking great. And I just thought it was something that felt right. I was there in WWE in 1989. I knew what he meant to the fans. As I'm watching this, I'm thinking, man, it's one of the greatest heel turns ever. So I needed to sign off with something special. And that right there showed you the power of a great announcer and just a great announcing moment. Those are those memorable moments, and we don't really get those anymore. I feel like we don't get as many of them. So maybe sometimes people don't really appreciate the importance that a good announcing job can have on a big moment like this. Now, I can still remember when Bret Hart came back to WWE in 2010, the night on Raw when he attacked Vince McMahon. Might have been his first night back. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was a few weeks later. But he attacked Vince, right? I think he punched him and he was going after him. You would think Michael Cole on commentary was fucking catatonic. I still remember that, but for all the wrong reasons. I'm like, dude, show some life. I mean, I know these guys are a lot older now, but still, this is Bret Hart attacking Vince McMahon. This should be a bigger deal. And he's just like, you would think that he had no energy. There was no life to it. Again, the announcing can be so important in these big moments. But you will not find any other wrestler in history, at least not in this country, who was as central a figure and important a figure to business, both as a babyface and then later as a heel. I mean, we've seen people who are huge babyfaces. We've seen people that are huge heels. But to see two different periods in history, and you had Hogan as a babyface, as important as he was to that expansion, that national expansion in 1984, and then to see how important he ended up being to WCW as a heel in 1996, I mean, that just doesn't happen. 24 years ago this week, on July 6, 1997, the greatest pay-per-view that WWE has ever produced, top to bottom, not named One Night Stand 2005, there is not a single down match on this entire show, which emanated from the Calgary Saddle Dome. Canadian Stampede in your house, the final 2 hour in your house before all pay-per-views move to a 3 hour format. And then eventually a 4 hour format, and WrestleMania moved to a 5, 6, 7, 8 hour format. Which is why I can appreciate the 2 day WrestleManias that we've had, which I still think is too much, but these events have only grown in the years since. But it was a short show, as in they only had 4 matches, but there was not a bad match among them. This is a show that you must see if you have never watched it before. Triple H and Mankind had an excellent opener. WWE, in its quest to compete with WCW's cruiserweight division, started a light heavyweight division of their own. That was not nearly as successful, and they gave up on it quickly anyway. They brought in the great Sasuke and planned to use his match on this show with newcomer Taka Michinoku as a showcase for Sasuke. But a funny thing happened. Taka was even more impressive than Sasuke was, and ended up being signed to a contract and made the centerpiece of the division. Undertaker was supposed to defend the WWE Championship against a newly heel Ahmed Johnson, but in a shocking turn of events, Ahmed blew out his knee 2 weeks before the match. I know. I am as shocked as you are that Ahmed Johnson was injured. Coincidentally, he was replaced in the Nation of Domination by Rocky Maivia, who went on to do a few things in his career. So in his place, they slotted in Vader against The Undertaker as a last-minute replacement, and the two of them had a great big man match. I still remember how impressive I thought it was seeing Undertaker hoist up Vader for the tombstone, which I'm sure he had done before, but yeah, and Vader helped a lot by literally running at him and jumping up into his arms. But still, I mean, by this point in his career, Vader wasn't exactly in the best of shape. He was a big dude. And I thought it was still very impressive. But then we had the main event. A 10-man tag featuring Bret Hart, Owen Hart, the British Bulldog, Jim Neidhart, and Brian Pillman, who would later on say that this match was the most fun he ever had in his career. Taking on Stone Cold Steve Austin, Ken Shamrock, Goldust, and the Legion of Doom. A main event of which only 4 of the 10 participants are still alive. This was as perfect a match as you could possibly ask for. In terms of crowd heat, the crowd was molten hot that night. The entrances for each member of the Hart Foundation, the people got progressively louder as they built to Bret Hart's entrance. Bret Hart, who was the biggest heel in the company that year, but in Canada, he was the biggest babyface. They were all babyfaces that night, in terms of crowd investment, in terms of just nonstop action, intensity. There's a part in the match early on where Bret is just kicking the shit out of Austin in the corner, and the hard cam is literally shaking. The building is literally shaking. And this is not even 5 minutes into the match. You know, in a lot of ways, this match reminds me of the 10-man tag I sometimes talk about. That's one of my favorite Raw matches of all time from February of 2000. Monday Night Raw from Dallas, Texas with Triple H and the Radicals against The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool. I mean, we see 6-man matches, 8-man matches, 10-man tag team matches thrown out on television all the time. But it's rare that everything just comes together as perfectly as it did here. And Owen rolled up Austin for the win with a fistful of trunks to build to their match at SummerSlam. You had all the Hart family members at ringside. There was some drama with Bruce Hart where he threw a really hard shot at Austin's kidney that hurt him. And then he started making his own big babyface comeback on the Americans out on the floor, which... Bret said in his book that Owen was pissed about because he felt like Bruce was taking away from his big moment there at the finish. You got Bruce going into business for himself. But what a chaotic finish. Austin came back out with a chair to go after the Hart members. He gets cuffed by the cops. He's flipping off the Canadian crowd with the handcuffs on as he's being escorted out. Hart family members pour into the ring to celebrate. See, a young Teddy Hart even is there in the ring before all of his troubles. In his book, by the way, Bret tells a funny story. He's in the ring. Everyone's celebrating, right? The match is over. He's in the ring. He looks over and he sees this kid that he doesn't know. And he goes over to the kid and he goes, "Who are you?" And the kid tells him, "Well, I just told him I was a Hart and they let me in." And Bret tells him to wave at the crowd and just enjoy himself. But as perfect as this all was, as rabid as the crowd was, imagine how they would have been if they had been able to go with the original lineup for this match, which did not involve Ken Shamrock or Goldust. The original plan for this match would have had, on the babyface side, Stone Cold tagging with Shawn Michaels, and Psycho Sid and LOD. Michaels had gone home after his little backstage hair-pulling fight with Brett. He was very unhappy. He was trying to leave the company, and Vince wouldn't let him go. Vince said, if you want, you could sit at home for the next 4.5 years of your contract, but you ain't going to WCW. This is when Shawn supposedly brought his father with him for a meeting with Vince and was trying to get out of his contract, and Vince was not having any of that. So Michaels was not available, I guess, at the time, and Sid had been in a car accident. He was out hurt. He was a little banged up. But my God, the heat that Shawn Michaels, I know this is pre-Montreal, but even then, he was feuding with Brett. Just imagine the heat that Shawn Michaels would have had in Calgary that night. It's the only thing I would have changed about the match. Was sticking with that original lineup, take out Shamrock, take out Goldust, and put in Sid and Michaels. 23 years ago this week, on July 6th, 1998, WCW reached its zenith with the undefeated Bill Goldberg challenging Hollywood Hulk Hogan at the Georgia Dome in Atlanta in front of 40,000 fans, or as Tony Schiavone called them on TV, 39,000. I've never heard an announcer actually undercount the attendance. I've heard plenty of wrestling announcers exaggerate the attendance and round up, but I don't think I've ever heard of an announcer giving a lower figure than the actual number of people who were in the building that night. But this was the biggest crowd in WCW history for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. It was all downhill from here for WCW. Now, why give away such a big match like this on free TV and not on their Bash at the Beach pay-per-view 6 days later? Well, originally, this was not supposed to be a title match, nor was it supposed to be even airing on television. It was going to be a dark match main event for the Georgia Dome crowd only. But a couple of things happened. There were going to be a group of Turner executives in attendance for the show, so it would be a real coup for Hogan to be able to take credit for the large crowd that night. But also, Nitro was getting clobbered by Raw pretty much every week at that point in the ratings. And this is when ratings really mattered to you know, McMahon and Bischoff, and Bischoff especially. He was studying the numbers every week and lived and died by those television ratings. And they were in panic mode. They were looking for something big to draw an audience, and this was their shot, and it worked. Nitro beat Raw that night 4.4 to 4.0, with the Hogan-Goldberg match becoming the first quarter hour in cable television history for pro wrestling to crack 5 million total homes, which was good for more than 7 million viewers, to witness Goldberg's championship victory. This, to me, and I'd be curious to know if you guys agree with this analogy, but to me, this felt like WCW's Hogan-Andre. Only instead of the slam, it was the jackhammer. And Hogan this time was the one doing the honors. That's what this match felt like. That's what this match still feels like when I go back and I watch it. And the big crowd has a lot to do with that. You know, and Goldberg getting the big win in the end, and just seeing this enormous crowd erupt, and what a big moment it was for WCW. I look at that moment there as their Hogan-Andre. And the reaction when Goldberg won, you know, to look out into that, just a sea of fans high-fiving each other and celebrating, was awesome. And then 6 days later, Hogan was in the main event tagging with Dennis Rodman against DDP and Karl Malone, with Goldberg defending the title underneath against Kurt Hennig. Goldberg's epic reign would continue the month after at the Road Wild pay-per-view, where he was again working underneath in a battle royal, while Hogan worked another celebrity tag team match in the main event against Jay Leno. In September, he wasn't even booked on the Fall Brawl pay-per-view, even though that didn't stop WCW from putting him on the artwork, on the cover artwork on the VHS, which would lead you to believe that he was on the show, but he wasn't. But guess who was? Guess who was in the main event? Hollywood Hogan. Halloween Havoc in October had Hogan against Warrior, second from the top. And Goldberg finally got to defend his title in a main event, only for the pay-per-view to run long, which caused, I think, most or all of the cable companies carrying the show to cut the feed right in the middle of their match. WCW had to replay it for free on Nitro the next night as a make-good. Fast forward to the World War III pay-per-view in November, and again Goldberg, the world champion, not booked. It's like Dennis Stamp. I'm not booked. I'm not booked, Terry. I'm not booked. And when Goldberg finally, at the end of the year, gets an uninterrupted main event at Starrcade, a big title defense on pay-per-view, Kevin Nash beats him and ends the streak. They gave Goldberg a Chris Jericho or CM Punk reign with the belt. Or maybe it's more appropriate to say that Jericho and Punk got Goldberg runs with the belt. But they at least got more main events than Goldberg did. 21 years ago this week, on July 9th, 2000, WCW held its final bash at the Beach pay-per-view, and it was not without controversy. Jeff Jarrett was to have defended his WCW championship against Hulk Hogan and retained, according to Vince Russo. Eric Bischoff has disputed this and said Russo's plan was overruled, and Hogan exercised the creative control clause in his contract to have the match finish changed to Hogan going over and winning the belt. And he was very fearful that Russo had no plans for him coming out of the show. What we know is that Jeff Jarrett laying down for Hogan to pin him and win the title was a work. We know that. As were Hogan's comments immediately after that, it's bullshit like this, why this company is in the damn shape that it's in. This was Russo trying to shock everybody into believing that it was a shoot when it was a work. That is, until it became a shoot later in the show, when Russo came back out, and he cut a scathing promo on Hogan, unbeknownst to Hogan, who never approved such a promo and had already left the building. There's Russo in the ring on live pay-per-view calling Hogan a politician and telling the crowd that he played his creative control card. I mean, he may as well have just held up a friggin' sign that said, "This shit is fake." He said, "You'll never see that piece of shit again. The belt that Hogan took is now the Hulk Hogan Memorial belt because that belt don't mean shit." He said Jeff Jarrett was still officially the WCW champion and he would be defending the title later in the main event against Booker T. And he says, "Hulk Hogan, you bald son of a bitch, kiss my ass." Hogan would later sue Russo and WCW over that promo for defamation of character and breach of contract. Russo had his legal bills paid by Time Warner, and in exchange, he could not work for any other wrestling promotion, which was a provision that he got waived when Vince McMahon rehired him in 2002 for all of a week, which then paved the way for him to join TNA. The defamation portion of the suit, I know that was dismissed. I believe they settled on the breach of contract portion, though, in 2005. Overshadowed in all of this is that Booker T won his first of five WCW World titles that night. So he would wind up being the beneficiary out of all of the wackiness that happened that night. 20 years ago this week, on July 9th, 2001, with all plans for a WCW relaunch now completely abandoned, and Buff Bagwell fired, coming off the disaster of a main event the week before on Raw against Booker T, WWE decided upon a new plan. On Raw is War from Hotlanta, GA, Kane was set for a handicap match against the team of Mike Awesome and Lance Storm. Chris Jericho comes out and he offers to be Kane's partner. He wants to be a team player because remember, they're heading into an Invasion pay-per-view in a couple of weeks. By the way, this is why the entire angle I'm about to talk about even happened. They were in a panic after the WCW stuff fell apart, all the plans they had. They had an Invasion pay-per-view to try to get people to buy, and this was their way to try to get people excited. So Jericho offers to tag with Kane. Late in the match, Tommy Dreamer and Rob Van Dam do a run-in. They make their official WWE debuts, even though they had both appeared on Raw years earlier as part of the first ECW Invasion angle. They run in, they attack Jericho and Kane, and soon it's 4-2. Until the WWE stars storm down to the ring to make the save. Now, oddly, the WWE stars were all former ECW names. We see the Dudley Boys, we see Taz, we see Raven, we see Rhino, and there's Just Incredible. And soon they all turn at the same time to face Jericho and Kane. And they attack. 10-2. Jim Ross is flipping out on commentary. He's demanding that Paul Heyman explain what's going on. Heyman, who's been working as a WWE announcer since ECW folded, says, "You want to know what this is? You want to know what this is about?" And he gets up from the announce desk. He climbs into the ring. He grabs a mic. And he cuts this fiery promo. Calls Jim Ross a fat pig. He's tired of people talking about WWE against WCW when they've forgotten about the Tribe of Extreme. This invasion, he says, just got taken to the extreme. And at the end of the promo, they played the ECW theme song. WWE would go on to use the ECW logo and likeness, all of which they had no ownership rights to. It was still tied up in bankruptcy. But I guess they figured they were going to end up, you know, owning the IP and the tape library at some point anyway, so fuck it. Let's just use it. But legally, they did not have the right to use any of that. This was a brilliant angle that made you think we were not only getting WWE against WCW, which is something every superfan had dreamed of, right? That we would one day have this interpromotional supercard or some kind of invasion between WWE stars and WCW stars. And not only might we get some version of that, but now you throw ECW into the mix as sort of the wild card renegade group. If they would have ended the show right there, it would have been one of the greatest Monday Night Raw endings of all time. But they could not help themselves. And less than an hour later, it all came crashing down. When the WCW stars and the ECW stars, who should have been kept apart and not friendly, they united as one. It was the birth of the alliance. Paul Heyman embraces Shane McMahon, and Stephanie McMahon is introduced as the new owner of ECW. Once again, making it all about the McMahon family. Making it all about Vince against his kids, as if we haven't seen this before. They squeezed about at least six months, maybe a year. I think I'm being generous when I say 6 months worth of television and storylines into 2 hours and hotshot at this angle, all in a panic because they had an invasion pay-per-view to sell. And, you know, making Shane McMahon the owner of WCW, you remember the whole simulcast show, you know, the name of the contract is McMahon, but it's not Vince McMahon, it's Shane McMahon, right? This big angle they did, and Shane is the owner of WCW. You know, that had its merits. Because people like Shane, coming out of WrestleMania, the match with Vince and everything, he was the babyface of the family. He was the one that people liked. And if they wanted WWE fans to like WCW, who they would just, for years, they beat up on, they're the enemy, they're evil, they're the bad guys. If you wanted to try to get your own fans to like WCW, I can understand putting Shane McMahon with them. But putting Stephanie with ECW as the owner of ECW, that was a bridge too far. But really, the issue is this. Here's the issue. When I talk about how badly botched the invasion, and it was, you may have liked the invasion, and I will sit here now and tell you that as compared to a lot of what we see today on WWE television, I would gladly take the invasion, okay? But put that on the side. If you like the invasion, good for you. The fact is, it was botched. It's not an opinion. That is a factual statement. And the issue is that when I talk about this, it's not about any one wrestler, it's not about any one match, or any one pay-per-view, or any one segment. There was a story to tell over the course of an entire year if they told it right. and they lacked the patience. And I understand that they couldn't get some of the names because they had these big contracts. You know, they could have shelled out money perhaps for some of them, but you had all these big names that were sitting at home, so they were a little bit handicapped by that. But they had other names. Okay, you see the way they treated some of them. They lacked the patience to do it the way that it deserved to be done. This was a once-in-a-lifetime angle that was dumped in their lap. They were handed a gold mine. And they flushed it right down the commode. 19 years ago this week, on the July 8th, 2002 episode of Monday Night Raw, live from Philadelphia, an infamous show that gave us not only one of the more memorable injuries in history, but also one of the worst matches in WWE history. Kevin Nash, in his very first match back from the torn biceps he suffered months earlier, suffered his second major injury since re-signing with WWE 7 months earlier. He had wrestled a grand total of 6 matches up to this point on a contract that was said to be paying him $700,000 a year as a downside guarantee. On this night, he was part of a 10-man tag team main event, pitting Nash, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, Big Show, and X-Pac against Booker T, Rob Van Dam, Goldust, Bubba Ray, and Spike Dudley. And many of the names I just mentioned had already wrestled in other matches, singles and tag team matches, earlier in the night. So, clearly they were very thin on roster depth at this time. Nash was not even supposed to be wrestling at all that night. He only found out once he got to the building that, you know, Brian Gewirtz, who was, I think at that point he was the new, I don't know how new he would have been at that point, but he was the head writer. He gets to the building and finds out that Brian Gewirtz has decided to bump his return up a few days. He was going to be back at some of the live events later in the week. He gets to the building and says, hey, you're wrestling tonight. He didn't even have his gear with him. He had to have a friend go to his house to retrieve his gear and get it on a flight out so he can get to the building in time. He was very vocal backstage about being put in a match on such short notice with no time to prepare. He hadn't wrestled a match in months. He didn't even have his knee brace with him. If you watch the match back, the moment Nash tags in, he rubs his left knee. That was the leg that ended up getting hurt. He kind of, like, it's like a 2-second thing, but he reaches down and he rubs his knee as if it was starting to cramp up or something. And then after delivering a big boot to Booker T, he tried to step over Booker to go to the corner to throw a forearm at Bubba Ray on the apron. And immediately he grabs his leg in agony and he crumbles to the mat. He is screaming in pain in a way that did not exactly project the badass aura that they were hoping for. He was screaming. And the match fell apart at that point. And everybody just started brawling. Shawn Michaels was on the outside. He started directing traffic as best he could. But Nash, he tore his quad. He tore his quad the way Triple H did, but he did not finish the match the way Triple H did, which was probably a smart thing for him to stay down. The Pro Wrestling Torch that week said that after the injury, Brian Gewirtz was said to be very quiet backstage. I'll bet he was. Vince McMahon was said to look shaken, probably because he realized he just lost one of his SummerSlam main events. I mean, the injury really screwed up their plans. The plan was for Nash to mow down all but one of his opponents in that match with big boots before hitting Booker T with the jackknife and pinning him. They wanted Nash to come across as a monster. And if you recall, in storyline, Kevin Nash and Shawn Michaels, they had a standing offer for Triple H to join the NWO at the Vengeance pay-per-view. And as I understand it, the plan would have been for Triple H to reject their offer, and that would have then led to a singles match at SummerSlam in 02 between Triple H and Kevin Nash. And then the other big main event would be Rock and Brock, which ended up happening, for the Undisputed title. Instead, this injury killed the NWO completely dead, once and for all, because you had Nash out, Scott Hall had already been fired, Hulk Hogan had already been turned babyface. So that left Shawn Michaels, Big Show, and X-Pac as the lone remaining members of the NWO. Because they had already kicked out Booker T. The following week, Vince McMahon walked out on television. He officially disbanded the group. And with Nash out, Austin having already walked out on the company, Undertaker not really drawing very well on top as the champion, the pressure was on Shawn Michaels to return to the ring, which he did, and the rest is history. But to this day, you cannot go one comment thread anywhere on the internet, any comment thread, tweet thread about Kevin Nash, you can't go one comment thread without there being at least one quad joke. But that same night, earlier in the show, featured a mixed tag team atrocity, pitting Bradshaw and Trish Stratus against Chris Nowinski and Tough Enough Season 2 co-winner Jackie Gaeta, who had absolutely no business being in the ring on live TV. She had only won Tough Enough a few weeks before this. And they thought it would be a smart idea to put her in the ring on live television on Monday Night Raw, what, 2 weeks later? It went about as well as you would have expected. This was the longest 3 minutes in Raw history. She was completely lost in there with Trish. They botched so many moves. I felt so bad for Trish. The finish was Trish Stratus coming off the ropes for what was supposed to be a bulldog. Trish did her part. She came off the ropes and landed on her ass, but Jackie didn't go down. She just stood there. And then all of a sudden, 2 seconds later, a delayed reaction. She sold it like an assassin's bullet had taken her out. Then she fell down. And she was the winner of Tough Enough. Imagine what the losers must have looked like. 16 years ago this week, on the July 11th, 2005 edition of Raw from East Rutherford, New Jersey, the old Meadowlands. Matt Hardy made his WWE return 3 months after being released by the company. While he was out with a knee injury, Matt found out that Lita, his girlfriend of 6 years, was cheating on him with Edge. And as if that wasn't bad enough, the guy is hurt, he's lost his girlfriend, WWE fires him due to unprofessional conduct in the way that he reacted to the situation online. The triple whammy. So he made a deal with Ring of Honor to work a date for them in July, but he was offered a deal by WWE to return. There was this, at least one, if not multiple, fan petitions online with thousands of signatures. People wanted Matt Hardy to be reinstated and get his job back. And he did, and the company heard, and they wanted to turn this very real-life situation into a television storyline and make money off of it, no matter how uncomfortable it may have been for the people involved. So they went to Matt with an offer to bring him back. And on this edition of Raw, he returned. He ambushed Edge, first in a backstage segment, and then again later in the ring, before security swarmed him and cuffed him to take him out of the building. He called Lita a whore. He told the fans to come see him at Ring of Honor, where he wrestled that weekend before being hauled off. It was a well-done angle. It was a well-done angle playing off real-life events, but I still say when Vince McMahon brought him back to Raw a few weeks later and put a live mic in his hand, it was that promo that killed his push dead, because that feud with Edge that came after that, the SummerSlam match and everything, that did him no favors whatsoever. And I think it goes back to that promo on the August 1st episode of Raw. I think that was Vince McMahon giving this guy a chance, giving him a live mic. All right, kid, let's see what you can do. It's not a terrible promo or anything. If you go back and watch it, you know, it's about 8 or 9 minutes long. It's not a terrible promo, but he couldn't deliver it in a way, I think, a convincing way that it needed to be delivered. And I think what also worked against him, and I don't know if this was scripted for him or if he just came up with this on his own, but he lost the crowd near the end of that promo when he said the only thing that would make him happier than getting his hands on Edge was if he was killed in a car accident before he could get his hands on him. He actually said this, And you could hear a pin drop. The crowd did not know how to react to that. Even Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler on commentary, you can hear them. You can audibly hear them, like, cringing. It did not get, like, an ooh. It didn't get applause. It was like, oh, my God. Like, I mean, that's a hell of a thing to say. But it didn't work. It just didn't work. And I think that, I really believe that was the night that ultimately killed him. I really do. 8 years ago this week, on the July 8th, 2013 episode of Monday Night Raw, the Wyatt family made its main roster debut, being called up from NXT. After Kane's victory over Christian, they laid out Kane. God, has it really been 8 years? 8 years. Brody Lee is missed. And that early Bray Wyatt character, it was great. It really was. I went back and I was watching some of those original vignettes that were airing on TV that kind of built to the debut. That character was great. Days later, on July 11th, 2013, WWE officially opened its new Performance Center in Winter Park, Florida. This is the anniversary of the PC. What would they have done without the PC last year at the beginning of the pandemic era? They're very lucky to have that building, which I don't believe they own. I think they lease it, they rent it. I don't think they actually have ownership of it, but they are very lucky to have it. 6 years ago this week, on July 5th, 2015, Kazuchika Okada defeated AJ Styles in an outstanding match to reclaim the IWGP Championship at the New Japan Dominion show from Osaka. I can still remember the finishing sequence, the final 30 seconds of that match. Awesome. One of the very best matches of 2015. 5 years ago this week, on July 5th, 2016, Impact Wrestling presented the final deletion match from the Hardy compound between Matt and Jeff Hardy, which popularized the concept of cinematic-style matches, which is not to say that they had never been done before, but they had never been done like this. This was broken Matt Hardy at his peak. Dixie Carter had no idea what they planned on doing when they filmed this, but she had signed off on it anyway. And Matt was really the mastermind behind it. He had some help from his brother and from Jeremy Borash and even Billy Corgan. And 1 year ago this week, on July 8th, 2020, NXT presented night two of its two-week Great American Bash, featuring a champion-against-champion, title-for-title, winner-take-all main event, pitting NXT champion Adam Cole, Bay Bay, against North American champion Keith Lee. Cole had been NXT champion for 396 days coming into this show, or 403 days, as WWE recognizes it, since this was a taped show. Didn't air for a few more days. Lee won the NXT Championship that night, and it was a great moment that is very bittersweet, given how his career on the main roster has gone so far. On the anniversary of his win this week, Keith Lee tweeted, "Many of you are reminding me of this day a year ago. So much has happened since then, it feels so long ago. Patience, my friends. There is zero quit in me, so don't you quit on me. I miss you, and I love you." Here's hoping we see the big man back in the ring soon. You know, we may have a draft coming up soon at the end of August. Would be a nice surprise to see him pop up there. And that is this week in wrestling history. There's only 7 more weeks or so of this week in history before we wrap up. We are getting close to the 1 year mark since I brought the segment back. And when that happens, you know, when we hit the 1 year mark, we start repeating ourselves. So we must bring it to a, which I do every week anyway, but we must bring it to a close. We must bring the segment to a close, sadly, early on in September. I hope you all have been enjoying it as much as I have, you know, going back through everything. It is a metric ton of work every week that goes into this. You have no idea, but I will miss it when it's over. And I am open to your suggestions about what you might like to see replace it. I am planning on bringing back more of your mailbag questions, so it's very likely that just more Q&A is what we will be doing again at the end of the shows each week soon, but again, I'm open to your suggestions at all times, so by all means, if you got one, tweet me, email me, would love to hear from you.
I did get an email from Russell who wanted to know if I had watched the fight on the farm between the Briscoe brothers from Ring of Honor last week, I guess it was. And I did. I did. I took the time to go and I watched the Jay and Mark Briscoe fight on the farm because they actually do own a, I think it's a chicken farm up north somewhere. And this was, it was cinematic, but not cinematic. It was not even cinematic. I mean, it was basically on location. And their father, Papa Briscoe, was there. And I guess, you know, Jay and Mark have been having issues and they've been having disagreements. And so their father said, all right, you guys are going to fight it out. You're going to get it out of your system now. You guys are the greatest tag team of all time, blah, blah, blah. You guys have to hash this out. And there's a ring that they have in a shed there on their property. Very dilapidated looking ring. The ring ropes are all loose. There's dirt everywhere. There's no mats on the floor outside. And they just went at it. You know, for about 10 or 15 minutes, they had this extended fight that eventually poured out of the ring and onto the grass and on top of a shed and in a pickup truck and then back to the ring. Until finally, at the end, their father just kind of stood over them and said, okay, are we done now? Did you guys kind of get it out of your system? So I enjoyed this, actually. It reminded me a little bit of the like what we saw from the Hardy compound, only without all the magic and all the gaga and all the bullshit from Final Deletion. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. You know, when you do these matches on location like that, they can be hit or miss. I thought this one was a hit. I enjoyed it. It's been a while since I've actually seen the Briscoes because I don't watch Ring of Honor week to week. But I've seen my fair share of Briscoe's matches, especially in person. It's kind of it's kind of weird that they're still, after all these years, you know, they've stayed true blue to Ring of Honor. Although I guess WWE kind of, you know, passed on them with the whole, all the tweets and stuff from years ago with Jay Briscoe. They might have made the jump back then, but they've been Ring of Honor through and through, and they're still there. And if you did not see the fight on the farm, I would look for it and watch it. I thought it was enjoyable. And as far as the other questions I got, keep sending them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. We'll be hopefully increasing the load of mailbag questions on the air if I don't respond to you directly. So I always want your questions. The email address never changes. Just include your name and where you are from when you write in. I would appreciate that. Follow me on Twitter at Solemonster. Is my handle on there. Especially during the live pay-per-views. We'll be live next Sunday on YouTube after Money in the Bank. And I'll be on Twitter during the pay-per-view. And of course, don't forget, we are doing the Solemonster Custom Belt Giveaway, courtesy of WrestleRumble.com. You guys have 1 week left to enter the contest. I want to see you win. I want one of the people listening to this show right now to win. The only way to do that is to go to WrestleRumble.com. It's $1 to enter. All it takes is one. You can buy one entry, you can buy 100 entries, but all it takes is one. And it could be you. And this thing is a beauty. I've got one of my own. Whoever wins, you will be the only other person to own this championship belt. So go to WrestleRumble.com. We got some other cool stuff too with WrestleRumble coming up in the next few weeks. I don't want to give it away right now. But we are going to be doing some cool shit. So head on over there and sign up. So I'm going to be back with you next Sunday, pre-Money in the Bank. It'll be episode 713 of The Sound Off. I'll keep you guys posted during the week on Twitter and on YouTube, too, if I'm able to. Maybe we'll go live, do some Money in the Bank predictions. But if not, we'll definitely have the predictions next weekend with the pay-per-view coming up. Join me on Wednesday after the night one episode of Fyter Fest, AEW Dynamite. I'll be live on YouTube. And that's about it. That's all I got. So have yourselves a great week. Be well, stay safe. And I will see you back here next Sunday for 7:13. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
What is the point of Tony Schiavone even coming down to the ring to do these interviews if every single time they pull the microphone out of his hand? There were a couple of AEW diehards who got very upset. Oh my god, you're criticizing. But these will be the first fucking people. If WWE did something like this, oh, they'd be online. Oh my god, WWE, look at this. What a shit product. God forbid you say something negative about AEW. Holy shit. The world is just falling down all around us. You people gotta cool your jets. Don't tell me what to tweet on my Twitter. You can go fuck yourself.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.